Good morning, everybody. The agenda for today, 12 May 2015, is as follows. Opening and welcome, apologies, adoption of the agenda, presentation by CCMA on the challenges of the British government on the building of offices, deliberations on the presentation, and then closing remarks. Thank you, Chair.
Could we please, as a committee, just suspend for tomorrow and the changes in the program? Because we've changed last week because of some unforeseen circumstances. Now we're changing tomorrow, and I just want to get updates on where these other things are going to be slotted in, but it's not got to do with the CCMA.
So you suggest that when
after
we have done the changes, left behind? Okay. I don't think we can see a very problem with that. Apologies.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies that I received today are as follows. Honorable Member Mantashe is in the trade and industry. Ms. Ongwane also in agriculture. Mr. Mbeka is attending sports. Ms. Njobo is attending public works. And also Mr. Matisha is not here. That was the only apology that I received. Thank you.
Thank you, Zolan. This is not our normal committee day, so most members are in their committees. But the issue that we are dealing with does not really need to come around. We can go ahead. Thank you for coming, and let's hear what you have thought about. I'm reminded in the agenda, adoption of the agenda, is the honorable member Salve is not on the refreshing adoption. Ms. Noreen, your team,
Thank you, Chair. But I would start by introducing who's present, and that would be in order with you. Thank you very much for affording the CCMA the opportunity to come and talk to the committee about the challenges we face in the development of the building in the Western Cape. But before I start, Chair, I could just introduce delegation that I thought would keep me. And on my left is the CEO of the CCMA, Ms. Ntombi Bakunso. As you all know, many of the issues here relate to supply chain management, which fall under the financial officer's section. Next to her, Cameron Moriani, the National Senior Commissioner for Legal Services, and the other challenges that came on to fall within his expertise. Then next to her is the chairperson of the governing body, Mr. Daniel Dube, who is here a member of the governing body. Then behind me is the National Senior Commissioner for Mediation and Collective Bargaining, Ms. Asla Subedar. And next to me is Dawid Dada, who is the manager in the Director's Office for Care Support Logistics in relation to this. And importantly, chairperson, if we go to the back row, I have the Western Cape Office Management here in case there are any questions that may be asked of them. And that is the Registrar, which is Mr. Raina Harris. Next to her, Senior Commissioner, Kelsey Lahoko. Next to him is Colton Johnson, who is the Convening Senior Commissioner of the province. And then other members of my Executive Committee, Nathan Govender, Chief Audit Executive in the front, but in front of him, Sarah Zeller. Next to him, Ronald Bernico. And then turning to our governing body representation, we have Mr. Lukoga representing Labour, next to him David Lackey, who serves on our Finance and Audit Committee, and then next to him is Sabita Lukela, who is a member of the governing body for Business and Human Resources Committee chairperson, and then Kimikolian Felipe is here as a member of government of our governing body, but he is also here to represent the Department of Labour. And then we have our Health Communications and Strategy, Ron Museme. And that is the delegation that I brought today, Chairperson. What we will be doing is, and those who are sitting with me will be the speakers, but if there are questions that we need to defer to other people in case there's a question that we don't may have the exact detailed knowledge, we will then, with your leave, refer them after to assist us in answering those questions.
Can I propose that the Western Cape delegation come and sit behind you?
Thank you, Chair.
Because if there are answers that have to be researched to the natural for the most part of it.
Chair, perhaps I'll then move and I'll just carry on introducing and setting up, or should I just wait? Okay, we'll wait. Show from the Chair. Thank you very much. Thank you. So the management is very appreciative of the committee affording us some time to explain in relation to the challenges we've had in the procurement of the Western Cape lease, or the Western Cape venue for holding services and the lease related to it. I recall that in the previous occasion you said that you would like the management to come and explain what went wrong, and also in the context of that I want to hit this process by saying to you that the process we've had to follow is to make sure that we've done the right thing in relation to the precepts of the Public Finance Management Act and the obligations that we have as officials in relation to upholding the principles that do with procurement. And we would like to try and have an opportunity to take the committee through all those challenges in relation to it. There's much information in relation to it, and it's quite a complicated process. We have handed out to committee members a bound document which has got black binding on the sides, which is about 15 pages, to try and give members in writing what we're going to try and talk to today so that you would all have access to the process and how we're going to deal with it. Mainly I will be speaking and then I will be supported in that process by the Chief Financial Officer and the Head of Legal, obviously, as we've indicated, perhaps the management of the lead prompts if any questions are of a very technical nature because they were involved in relation to that. But I think if you look at the first slide that we put up, which is a presentation which speaks to the written document that we furnished to the committee, the important point is to look at the central square in the slide, which is that a significant change occurred in the process that we were conducting when we had the finding of a forensic court and that we established that the tender had been awarded to the wrong bidder and we had to take action based on that legal opinion. And as we stand at the moment, the process is still upholding and is still underway. But what is significant in relation to that is that on that advice, we were forced or needed to take and bring application to the High Court to set the tender award aside. Because once we had a forensic audit conducted, the challenge that we had was that we now knew that the award in the tender had been given to the wrong bidder based on the findings of the forensic audit. Now what's important is that initially, as you'll see in the block to the right, is that the forensic audit was conducted after we had had challenges in relation to the delivery of taking beneficial occupation of the building. Now beneficial occupation is a legal term, and what that means is that you can enter into a lease with an agreement. But if you are not able to actually go to the building, let's say there's no water, there's no electricity, the lifts are not working, lights, or whatever the challenges might be, the landlord is not tendering you what's called in law beneficial occupation. that means that you can't get the benefit that you paid for as the tenant. And therefore, in law, you would be entitled to say it's a challenge and we can't actually move in. Obviously, if there were little things like they hadn't painted the walls properly and maybe a crack here or a plug hadn't been put in properly, then that would have been different. But what happened in the process is that when a CCMA had followed an extensive supply chain process from 2012 all the way up to the end of 2013, was supposed to take occupation of the building in March last year, which was the date that it was intended to occupy the building. The challenge that arose was that the people that had been awarded the tender were actually unable to give a CCMA what's called beneficial occupation. And the challenges that arose are things of the following nature. That the lifts were in the building actually came out to have been more than 60 years old and didn't meet the public service compliance in relation to occupation health and safety, that they had tendered to the BTMA that they would be able to provide parking and that the parking was not actually available, and the solution that they were able to give us then declined on more than one occasion with different options by the city for permission, and that was a significant term of the tender. Now the challenge that then comes is that the other bidders could also challenge the CCMA in relation to the fact that they had different parking solutions, but one of the motivations in awarding that tender was the fact that the parking was in the building, and in particular the disability parking and lift access. We were also unable to get a certificate from the city of Cape Town saying that the building was not being able to be occupied, and we were having extreme challenges in actually getting delivery. Having said that, on the other hand, we had a building where, which is in Darling Street, where we had, the lease had expired. We had applied already, given the delay in getting occupation of the building, to the National Treasury to extend the old and existing lease. And the National Treasury had given us an extension of that lease based on the fact that we were in the tender process and we were needing to get delivery of the building. The intention had been that the moving date would initially be in November, then December, then January, and that's when partly came to the attention of the National Office that there was a challenge in relation to the award of this tender. So arriving out of that, we started investigating what the issues were and what the challenges were. I think it's very, very important for everybody to understand. As CCMA management, our intention was, after taking legal advice and looking at the processes, is to try and support the winner of the bid to actually ensure that we could move into the building and find a way of getting them or supporting them to try and ensure they got the building ready for us to move in. Challenges became so extreme in the context of the fact that there was a demonstration of lack of understanding, and then obviously because of the challenge we were obliged to report this both to our audit committee, our finance committee and our governing body. And a management team, and on the advice of everyone, and also of concern, that the organisation is now facing extreme risk because our key priority is to ensure that there's proper service delivery for all of the people who use the CCMA in the Western Cape province, and this is severely at risk. As a result of that, we decided that we needed to then actually conduct a forensic audit. So up until that point, our intention had been to try and see if we could find ways of moving into the building. What we did there, and we'll take you through in the presentation, is that we spoke to the new owners of the building who had been with the landlord and the winners of the bid, and discussed with them and moved the moving date, and in that process extended the old lease and dealt with the process of trying to assist them to actually ensure that we could actually get proper occupation of that building. The situation became so extreme and that there was such risk that we then decided that there might be something concerning, and so as a result, and because of the risk to the organisation, we then put out a process to have a forensic audit conducted on the award of the tender. As a result of that, the situation changed and the process then was redirected. Because the forensic audit then had 27 audit findings, which are very significant, and they find that basically the award was given to the wrong tenderer based on a set of processes. From that, we were given legal advice, and as the accounting officer then, because I now know, as I've now awarded a tender to the wrong person, I'm then obliged to then have that award certified. So having got the tender, we then made got advice from our lawyers and discussed it, and the process was then to make an application to the High Court to certify the tender that was awarded. In this process, and because there was some media interest, we had then also established that four of the unsuccessful bidders had also written to our supply chain department, which they hadn't disclosed at that point. and said that they were going to challenge the award of this building because they didn't believe that the process would be fairly followed. So on that basis, and based on that, and I got permission as the accounting officer from the governing body, as the executive authority, to bring an application to the High Court to set the award aside. This set off a whole set of other challenges, which we will take you through. Potentially, we were then in a situation where we faced having no building to move into, and as a result of that, we made application to National Treasury to allow us to extend the old lease in the Darling Street building. That essentially, at this point, covers why we are where we are at the moment. Maybe we can go to the next slide. So, essentially, as a background, the tender for the Western Cape offices was awarded to Provalco Investments in terms of a competitive bidding process on the 7th of January 2013. We were due to move into the building on the 1st of March. And as I've indicated, and as I tried to give example of the tenant installation, which is basically making the building ready for us to move into, was intended to be done actually by January so we could start the new year in the building, but because there were days that the time was extended, but the intention was always that we would move in to the building in March, and with the snags being dealt with. As a result of the forensic audit, the situation had to be changed, and we had to ensure that we changed the process. So, as I've indicated, we then made application to the court to set aside the tender. I'm going to then briefly ask the Head of Legal Services to take you through what the issues were in relation to High Court application, and then we'll deal with the findings in the forensic audit. Okay. All right. Let me go to the next slide, rather. And I'll go back to High Court investigation. The reason that we decided and that the governing body thought was appropriate to ensure that we had a forensic investigation was for the following. That, as I've outlined in very specific terms, that the bidder had failed to deliver beneficial occupation to the CTNA as we expected to be able to do, and that was a challenge to the organization. This led to the risk of the organization and led to a situation where the service delivery in the organization was compromised. And we were concerned about the capacity of the owners of the building to deliver that beneficial occupation ever. And as a result of that, in order to mitigate our risk, we appointed an external quantity surveyor who's a person who checks the building to make sure it's ready in time. And as a result of that, they gave us a shopping list of things that had not been addressed, some of which I've already mentioned, which are the details of the list, but they went down to the fact that electricity cables were open in the building, they hadn't been properly sealed up in the ceilings. The IT cable and the electricity cable running next to each other would have meant that the IT systems couldn't work properly because the electricity would interfere one with the other. So essentially what that came to show us is that there was perhaps not the skill and the capacity to deliver on the building in relation to that. And what the concern was, the lease was for 10 years, and that would the charges continue over the whole 10-year process as well. We then reviewed the lease agreement and arrived out of the lease agreement. The building was financed by Nedbank. And in terms of that lease agreement, that the agreement said that if there were any challenges in relation to the delivery of the building, that we should then look to the financier, which was Nedbank, to try and rectify those. So we did do that, and we gave notice to Nedbank, and we negotiated with them because in terms of the agreement, it said that there was a month in which to do that. And Nedbank asked us to extend that process. And we did do that, and then they tried to assist in getting the building ready for occupation. During that time of getting ready, we then had the results of forensic audit, which really changed how we were operating in relation to that. There was also a challenge at the time that while the owners of the building, as we put up there, were Provalco Investments CC, during the time they had actually changed the CC to a private company, and then they changed the name of the private company to Malfa Property Group Pty Limited, which was ultimately transferred in the deeds office to become the owner of property. And we then also asked them to agree to change the name in relation to that, having got legal opinion around the fact that we couldn't then say that the tender had been incorrectly awarded because it's not uncommon for people to change names in relation to that. I think it's significant to also note that the governing body, the audit committee, the finance committee, and obviously the management team believed the forensic audit was important because at that point in time, The Auditor General in the previous financial year had conducted an audit on the process, and while there were some concerns in relation to the process, it wasn't an unusual concern, and our internal audit department had also audited the process, and they had all felt, while there were some challenges in certain areas which had been asked to be addressed, they were addressed. And after that, there were still challenges that arose. So we believe that getting the input of an external independent person would be very important in relation to this process. I'm going to briefly then, on the next slide, take you through the findings of the forensic audit. Now, bearing in mind that audits, as I'm sure the members know, have critical findings, very critical, and then just matters for interest and things to be sorted out. But the key issues that were found were that the functionality of points that were applied in awarding the tender by the committees, so we had a bid specification committee, the bid evaluation committee, and the bid adjudication committee, so they all have a different role to play in the chain of events that lead to the awarding of tender, which then leads to the recommendation of that committee to the director and the accounting officer to award the bid, and that they had been incorrectly applied. There was a finding that there was a strong perceived bias in favour of the winning bidder, and the process indicated that there was a perception that the committees had decided in advance or influenced in advance to make that award. That the ratings that were applied to the different bidders, which were six of them, had been applied inconsistently, and that this had arisen because of the segregation of duties or the lack thereof in the supply chain process, and that the supply chain manager at the time had been in a position to influence each of the committees as the process moved forward. And then on top of that, between two of the committees, the specification process had changed. The specification of what was needed in relation to the award had changed. And as a result of that, the finding was that the bid had been awarded to the incorrect bidder. It's very important to note that the forensic finding indicates that the CCMA systems, so far as auditing requirements are concerned, which is there's a separation of functions, had actually been correctly set up, but it was about the fact that an individual was, as the expert advisor to everyone, was utilizing that in a process as it moves through the committee, and would have been quite tricky to pick up if you hadn't actually had time to evaluate in relation to that process. Arising out of that investigation, sorry, Chance. The finding indicated that the committee that CCMA is required to have in relation to a tender process, which I've intended to mention, and if you look on pages 9 to 11, I think they set out quite clearly in the document we furnished everyone, that the bid specification committee, which is the first committee which sits, which is what we require. Okay, so like you want to go to the shops buy 10 loaves of bread. Okay. Then the bid evaluation committee, which then looked at what we got in and evaluated, did we get in what we needed? And then they then recommend to the adjudication committee, which then sits and looks at everything from a viewpoint of judging is this correct and doesn't meet the criteria. What has happened in that process is that insofar as auditing and accounting principles and against those can maybe assist me further, one needs to have separate duties. So you can't have, it's like being a judge and a jury, or the referee and player. That's a better way of putting it, not the judge and the jury, the judge and the prosecutor. So what the finding was is that that there was one person who was actually sitting on all those committees as an expert advisor, and that was the supply chain manager, and as a result was able to carry the process through and look to as an expert advisor by everybody and therefore influence the outcomes of the process on all those committees which should have sat separately. But one sets up a structure in relation to the organization where the department is the expert advisor. So for example, on contracts, I would have the legal department as the legal advisor and finance department which advise me on finance issues. The supply chain manager is ahead and must advise on the supply chain processes and how those processes are followed. And what the audit finding is that individual had actually sat on all the committees and maybe other people in the department advised the people who are independent who sit on that committee incorrectly in relation to some of the processes. main finding in relation to an individual employee, but there were also findings in relation to other employees, which is important to note. Arising out of that finding, the management made representation to me as the accounting officer, and the supply chain manager was then suspended and charged with the offences that I'm describing in much more detail. And a disciplinary proceeding was implemented, the project started and commenced, and eventually through a process at the end of February he left the CCMA, and there was no settlement paid to him in relation to that other than the fact that he left with his last month's salary. And any statutory money that were owed would be obliged to pay under the law. It didn't mean that it didn't have other NAT officials who, in the findings, also misconducted themselves or maybe misconducted themselves. But it's important to note that in finding that that was seen as a key person who had manipulated the process. So we then also, in a long and elaborate process, got advice on how to proceed, and that there were members of the Bid Evaluation Committee and the Bid Adjudication Committee and other members who were involved in a process either as chairing committees, giving advice, conducting themselves, not signing minutes in the correct way. I mean, it's a very large range of offences that came out, and they were all called upon through different processes to make representation to the office of the director as the accounting officer as to why any further disciplinary action should be taken against them. And based on that process, either disciplinary action was taken, counselling, additional training was given, insofar as the Labour Relations Act recognises the principle of corrective action in relation to that process was also implemented and taken. Some of that is still ongoing, and because obviously, as you can see, because it takes time and it's still basically unfolding as the process goes on. And then moving to the next slide, we have, which is a summary. In relation to, I think one of the questions that we thought would be important for members of the committee to know, the money that we spent in relation to actually addressing this issue is set out here, bearing in mind that some of it is obviously to try and rectify the situation and some of it is in order to protect the organisation. For example, the supply chain manager, when the disciplinary process commenced, brought an urgent application to the Labour Court, and that the CCMA was then obliged to defend that process, which was then dismissed with the costing awarded in favour of the CCMA. And then there's other processes that happened. Because this matter involved all the senior people in the organisation, including members of the executive committee, it was decided that we needed to actually get independent people to make sure that the process was chaired independently, because it involved all the senior people in the organisation. Because an award ultimately is signed on the recommendation of the executive members and then by the accounting officer, which is myself. Moving then to the final slide that we have, and then I will go back to the High Court process. I just think it's important to take everybody through a couple of key points, and that is that when the independent advice that we've got shows the accounting officer and the accounting authority, which is the government body, that the offence has been awarded to the wrong bidder, we needed to do the right thing, which was to have the award set aside. In law, the only way to have an award set aside is to bring an application to the High Court to ask them to set aside that application. Now, we could have waited for one of the other unsuccessful bidders to bring that case, or we could have done it ourselves. And in our view, it was better to go to the court with our keen hands and say, look, this is what happened. Please, can you come to our rescue and set aside this award so we can reconsider the process. In managing that process, we've had to manage the risk in an ongoing way, which is the challenge of the fact that we needed to make sure the service delivery to the users of the CCMA was not interrupted. And doing that, we had to extend the lease of the old building and have had to negotiate with our landlord in relation to that. That building is not ideal. The offices have grown. The challenges that relate to it, but we have made progress going forward. I think what's also important, to date, as it stands now, we have not been able to show that there was any corruption by any CCMA officials, and that is where it is. What is important also is that when we identified the challenges of the lease, we hadn't moved into the building, and we didn't move into the building. We also didn't actually fulfill terms of the lease, and the unsuccessful bidder was never paid any rent in relation to the building at all. So insofar as protecting the state fund goes, CCMA did not pay over any money in relation to the lease to the incorrectly awarded bid. And that was an important point in relation to the fact that there could be a damages process. Where are we left now? The challenge goes is as follows. We have a High Court application which Cameron can take through in a little bit more detail. As court cases do, it takes a long time, and we're challenged by that process. We had extended the lease on the existing building to November this year, and we had hoped that the court case would have been resolved by now. It came to our attention not 2 weeks ago that the successful bidder, okay, so the incorrectly awarded bidder of that building, had actually sold the building without telling us, and we found that out a few weeks ago. We are trying to get from them what is their intention now. We have spoken to NetBank, and NetBank, who had initially defended the court case, has now withdrawn their defense of the court case on the basis that they have been paid their money because the building has been sold. Now, on the positive side of that is that if the process was awarded to the incorrect bidder, they had incurred certain costs, and that they could perhaps in law have had some kind of damages claim against CCMA, but on the same basis, CCMA could have had a counterclaim for all the things they had to do to manage the fact that they couldn't actually give us the profits that they were awarded in rights. And so that's what the situation is in relation to that. We are left at the moment with the situation that we have a court case to try to set aside the bid. It hasn't been finalized by the court. As a result, we are not in a position to go out and tender for a new building. We are faced with this potential challenge that in November of this year, the Cape Town office will have nowhere to conduct their services for the CDMA users because we are unable to go out on tender. But we are trying to get the attorneys for the unsuccessful, or for the successful bidder to come back to us to say what their intention is, because we have assumed, we don't know, that they may no longer have an interest in pursuing the matter. The CCMA's intention had been that if we were able to try and find ways that after the award was set aside and get an agreement from all the other bidders, and if the building was acceptable to us, that we would move in there, if that was an option, because the position of the building and the access in relation to that in the Cape Town city is favourable to what we would like to deliver in relation to service. The challenge that we have at the moment is that we face a situation where in November of this year, unless we get an extension from our old landlord, who has been a little bit reluctant to give extensions, one can understand, because we're also a bidder in this process, if he hits us out on the street, we might have nowhere to deliver the services of the CCMA. But we're very hopeful as a management team that if we work together and talk to all the relevant parties, that this will not come to pass, and we're already in a negotiation to try and see if we can find resolutions to that. Chair, I know that some of the questions that you may have are not, we're not able to answer, but please understand the time it is, because it's an unfolding process as we go along, and we try to be and disclose to the committee as honestly as we can the challenges that we face going forward. I think I would then like to ask maybe the head of legal and the chief information officer just to supplement all the things I've said to give further explanations. Okay. Pam?
Thank you. Madam Chair, I will specifically focus on the court case and add a bit of meat in some of the aspects that the director has covered. And I think it's important that the decision may reduce it, because some of the things that we read, especially from the media, about what is the action about and what its intention is, it is being misconstrued. And we want to, you know, put the House into confidence as far as what the actual issues are and what we intend to achieve from this, so that the House be fully appraised and understand fully the nature of education that we are bringing as a High Court. There are a number of aspects here, and there's two main processes that have run because of different issues, and I'll take you through that. The first hurdle that the CCMA encountered was the conversion of the name and the type of company that the successor bidder was. I think the director touched on that. What she did not touch on is the effect of that conversion. When the successful bidder, who subsequently became the lessor to the CCMA, changes the name of the company, effectively meant that the CCMA was contracted to the wrong people. Because the lease that was signed was signed with Portland, not with Marshall. So a legal process, as far as that was concerned, had to be done. And at that time, while that issue may have been serious at the time because of the contracting issue, because we wanted to get the match to proceed, we did not necessarily attack the validity of the contract, although it was available to us to attack the exchange because there were certain procedural aspects that had to be done for that convention to be made, especially as far as the system is concerned, because we were the tenant. The second issue which we had was there was a major problem in as far as the annex relating to the tenant information system, which effectively meant that when the actual lease contract was being implemented, it became a debate between the lessor and the fee as to what needed to be done or to be installed before the system into occupation. So because of that contractual issue, and it became the big problem in the execution of it that led to the 1st of March 2014. But there has been engagements that were done in order to ameliorate that problem. But the system did not take action as far as that part is concerned. What we've done was to engage with the successful bidder to try to agree to what needs to be done to ensure that we achieve what the director said called the beneficial occupation. At all times, even at this stage, the CCMA did not make its way to find this commitment to occupy, hence the participation of all the resources of the system to ensure that we assist the success of it in order to meet the standards and the participants in the contract phase. Now, the first biggest hurdle that I just touched on, but I want to deal with the consequences. It's an important date, which is the 1st of March 2014. The 1st of March 2014 is the date at which the building should have been delivered. I can confirm to you, as we have in the past, the building at that time, contracted, was not delivered to the system. Now, at that time, check again, from this ground alone, the CCMA was entirely legal to take action in the form of a breach of contract. That we had expected that by the 1st of March 2014, that the contract would be implemented in as far as allowing CCMA to occupy the building so that we can proceed as agreed. But on the 1st of March 2014, that did not happen. Now, the governing body of the CCMA has had to make a decision that if the building is not delivered on the 1st of March 2014 as expected, what does this mean? Effectively, it means the breach of contract. Now, we did exercise our discretion because in terms of the lease contract, it's expected that if the refractory breach that occurs, we are expected to serve a notice to NetBank, where the financiers to the successful bidder, informing that there are contractual problems in the application, that they must assist the successful bidder to ensure that we occupy the building. And we do accept that once that notice was served, NetBank decided to assist the successful bidder in order to meet specific requirements, but not to the extent as expected to meet the standard of what a beneficial occupation means. In that process, then a second phase, or let me say a second stream, actually, of the problem started. That's when, I don't want to repeat what the director said, but that's when the investigation started as well, seeing the problems relating to the capacity to deliver, on certain key aspects which are material to the contract. Now, the outcome of the investigation has been presented by the client. Now, here's the challenge that we face. While we were not pursuing the research in the aspect relating to the breach of contract, we did proceed in as far as the outcomes of that investigation are concerned. Now, in as far as it affected the issue, in taking the decision to act in terms of that investigation report, we were guided by the very document which enjoins everybody called the Constitution of the Republic. The Constitution of the Republic in terms of Section 2 says that amongst other principles that is contained in the procurement process, that the process must be fair, the process must be competitive. So if in the investigation it is not presented by the government, it becomes very clear that the calculation that was done in terms of the system that apply, as far as the regulations of the observer are concerned, were not complied with, then we have a problem that would mean that the very principles in terms of the constitution that were supposed to comply with have been affected, meaning that there is no fair competition, that there is no competition, that there's no transparency and such like principles contained in the Constitution. So informed by the Treasury regulations, informed by that important material principles of the Constitution, the governing board of the system took the decision that it is appropriate under the circumstances to take action and set aside the lease. Of course, after an extensive discussion with input from the investigator, with input from our attorneys. Now, what does then this application to court that is pending this stage is seeking to achieve? It seeks to achieve one, that the division and the recommendations that were made by the Peace Evaluation Committee, which is the fitting into the BEC, must be satisfied. Second, that a decision that was taken by the Peace Evaluation Committee, which is the final committee as far as the procurement area is concerned, that based on the evaluations and based on the recommendations that were done by the BEC, that the Peace Evaluation Committee took a decision to award to, in terms of the court paper, the first respondent, which is a marshal for Portaco. That decision was taken by the Peace Evaluation Committee, must be set aside. In addition to that, Chairperson, in understanding our procurement process, what the Peace Evaluation Committee makes a decision, it then makes a recommendation to the Director of Decision and Accounting Officer to then finally issue the letter of award, which then goes to Portaco or Milestone as the successful bidder. Part of this application and the limited result is that that letter, which was signed by the director, that awards the tender to Portaco, must also be certified. So the effect of that certification, that's all the institutional structures of the CCA, that the second decision that led to the awarding of this tender must, in this High Court application, be certified. I must confirm, Madam Chair, and it is of critical importance that you do so, that this application that we are talking about, it is not a breach of contract application. It is an application which is purely based in setting aside the award. There is no limit sought by the CCMA, financially speaking. And as I just said, there is no counter application against the CCMA to seek any limit for that matter. The only thing that has occurred is that NetBank, who are also one of the sponsors because they are the financial and the financial assessment process, have also withdrawn from the application. And the grounds of their withdrawal have been explained by the title of the CCMA. So, while all of that is happening, and the status, Chair, at this stage, I must explain, the status at this stage of this application is that it is still at the exchange stage. In other words, parties are still exchanging documents and all of that. We, at the time of the application, had anticipated that this process will take, as advised by the attorney, that the process will take 1 year. At this stage, we had hoped that it would be finalized, and we'll know exactly where we're standing. But because of the nature of the requests that have been made, because of the interlocutory issues and arguments involved in the exchange process, the process has taken longer than expected. So, as a result of that, we have no other way of ensuring that we expedite. So we are faced with the challenge that the director has explained. But I can confirm also, in as far as the papers are concerned, in as far as the conditions are concerned, while it may be that we have an obligation in terms of this itself to pay the fees, but because of the contraindication, we don't. And that's why there's no payment made. As a result, there's no fruitless or any irregular expenditure that is incurred or expended by the CCMA in as far as that process is concerned. While all this drama is happening, Madam Chair, then there's an additional application which was for us. I need to explain this because it appears in terms of the financial implications which are submitted. That Mr. Mayaba brought an urgent application to the Labour Court with an intention to set aside the suspension which was later against him based on the investigation with the other side. We have no option, of course, Madam Chair, because the decision to suspend him was a rational decision, which we, the decision we thought was a bad decision. And the courts on that same application confirmed that. And his finding is also reported in that system, Madam Chair, by the judge to deal with the judge. So that application was then set aside. So he remained on suspension. But that drama will continue, and there was an addition to it. But the disciplinary hearing, because now the investigation then had to proceed, and that disciplinary hearing continued. And I must also add, Chairperson, on the slide that the director presented, as far as the legal costs are concerned, that yes, we did incur legal expenses on different fronts. One of those fronts is the disciplinary hearing. Madam Chair, I must also inform the House that it was not just a disciplinary hearing that was going on at the time. The Senator also referred a dispute alleging unfair discrimination, feeling that he has been unfairly discriminated on the grounds of caste. Given the nature of that application, noting of course that the disciplinary hearing is proceeding, and of course that there was a lower court application that we had received, and also that there is a high court application that intends to set up the same amount, then we were then had no choice but to appoint legal again, the same law firm, so that was consistent with the purpose to appoint the same law firm that has dealt all the matters that I've just described. And in that instance, Mr. Yabo was granted legal representation as far as the disciplinary hearing is concerned, and he was fully represented throughout the whole process. And also ensured that the chairperson who's appointed is the chairperson who's also a practicing advocate and who's also appraised as far as the employment law issues are concerned. So the mental procedure. Hence the costs have been paid as a result of that process. Now, as the matter progressed, and I think the director is concerned, that there was no fraud allegations which were discharged. Because there was no fraud allegation which came out of the investigation. So as a result of that, Mr. Mayaba felt that given the nature of the application, the task that he brought and the disciplinary hearing having continued to that extent and cost association with it, he then approached the system and requested the system to release him from his contract. And what the motivation was that even if there is a perception of corruption and fraud, but there's nothing even alleged in the charge sheet that he referred. So he felt that for him, for his own creditworthiness, and for him to continue professionally, can he be released from the contract. At no stage, I can confirm, did the CCMA offer any money to settle the matter. Neither did he ask anyone to settle that matter. So the word settlement is used purely for the purpose of ensuring that we design what the process was that ended the process. It was purely based on him wanting to design, but he cannot just willingly resign when there is a disciplinary hearing that is proceeding. So the CCMA was faced with the choice of having to decide that if he resigns, that would mean the disciplinary hearing will stop. It means that then there's no finding that's going to be made, and the matter has no exchange of money, as you would find in a normal settlement process. Mr. Mayab did submit the resignation, and the resignation was considered a notion of post-legal speaking, that the resignation is a unilateral process which needs no requirement of an agreement from the CCMA. And such resignation was noted, and it was presented to the different bodies of governance of the organization, and the matter was resolved on the basis of that. So his last day decision was in March 2015. Now, Chairperson has met that I think the issues patient has been sorted as far as the fraud issue concerned. In as far as the current lease is concerned, Chairperson, we have, as the director presented earlier, that the lease was purely extended to cover the process of the litigation. And now the challenge that we are facing, legally speaking, is that the lease is ending in November 2015. And the court matter has not ended. And there's no end in sight, at least as far as this process is concerned. And now the real danger that we're facing is that by December, we may not have venue to house a Western Cape office. And there's no end up. So these are the nitty-gritties. I've left up technical aspect that relates to that. But I thought it is important that I present these aspects to the House so that at least you get first hand on what this application is. What is not, Chairperson, I may ask, is that even if the CCMA were to be unsuccessful in this application, this is the critical part that we must make very clear. It does not mean that the CCMA is liable for 100 million rand. It does not mean that. The result only means that the CCMA remains with a binding lease contract that we must ensure that it works for the next 10 years as contracted. That's all it means. Unless there was a different application, which would be in a summer session, that sued the decision for that amount because we committed the breach. But at this stage, there's no breach that we committed. The only breach that exists is the one that we did not action. But then we had the choice of two different actions. Either we action in terms of a breach, or we set it aside in terms of the application. And we chose to proceed with the application because we cannot be seen as an organ of state instead of the Constitution. That to be seen to be spiritually diligent in trying to enforce a contract that is in violation of the South African Constitution, and knowing that it is unconstitutional, we cannot do so. So we are driven by that decision, that if the Constitution says this is how it should be done, and we're going to do that, anything contrary to that cannot be enforced. It is therefore that the spirit and purpose that drives the application to set it aside. That is the essence, Madam Chair, of the application of High Court and the Association. Thank you.
The chairperson can clarify a few of the financial issues, and then we would
conclude. Thank you, Chair. just wanted to add is that arising from the findings that came from the forensic audit, as management, we saw a need to further strengthen our internal controls, and as such, having reviewed the recommendations that came from the forensic report to strengthen our internal controls, we have actually implemented and already practicing all those recommendations which we were checking throughout the course of the year. Just the key issue to address, or key internal controls to address the findings was around ensuring that we have different supplier officials at each bid committee to speak, that you have a different person who sits in the bid specification committee, another one in the bid evaluation committee, and a separate also at the bid application committee. Over and above that, as much as the supply chain officials are looked at as experts in the field to whom we different members sort of guidance and advice from, there is a responsibility also from the different committee members that they have. They obviously they cannot just rely on that we were told by the supply chain official to do such and such a thing. So they need to obviously apply their minds in what has been presented to them. So in addressing or strengthening further that control, we developed the checklist, which actually in line with the National Treasury Regulations that says if something comes before the bid certification, ensure that this list has been followed. So they need to check and ensure that that has been accomplished. And the chairperson of the bid committee in the case bid certification will need to sign off taking responsibility and accountability that they have ensured that they follow those processes. And the same process will follow through in the bid evaluation committee and also in the bid adjudication. And over and above that, continuous training in the bid committee members that also has been provided, and also to the entire supply chain officials. In fact, the rollout that we'll be having throughout the course of the year will be towards the entire organization in terms of the workshops that we have to take people through the processes of understanding the supply chain and the implications on the actions that they do to the organization. So that's the part that I wanted to add, to say that there's been a number of processes that we've done to ensure that we strengthen the controls. What we have on the slide is how much this process has cost the CMA as at 31st of March 2015, and the total amount is at 2.8 million rand.
Thank you, Chair. That in summary explains the challenges that the organization is facing. We've written in detail to the committee a detailed report, which is about 14 pages. But perhaps just to summarise in conclusion again, that we are waiting for the outcome of the court case. The challenge we face is that the building has now been sold to a new owner, and we haven't had any communication from them, and we're assuming that they're not interested in pursuing the matter with us. That we have a challenge insofar as the Western Cape Office of Service Delivery is concerned, in the context that the extension on the lease was to end of November of this year, and we need to find premises or find a solution to ensuring that we are able to deliver to the users of the CCMA in relation to that. And that we obviously have tried to ensure that all supply chain challenges that have come out of the process, although the process was exposed, have been addressed in relation to that. And that the important point is that as an organization, together with the governing body and our committees and as a management team, we have tried to do everything to manage the risk to the CCMA, the risk to the fiscus in relation to the challenges here, and to ensure when we were told that the award has been incorrectly made to satisfy our own award, and that when the award was known to have been given to the wrong bidder, no financial money part hands, and we didn't hand up any money in relation to that. I think from there, Chair, we would hand over to you and to questions from the committee. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Thank you for that information. Members, your time for clarification questions. A lot of for lawyer work, a lot of for some country, and that's all.
Thank you. Chair, having listened to the excerpt from PPMA, you would assume that nothing of this sort of irregularity would happen under their own nose or nose. But having said that, I want to be clarified. On page 2 of the report that is having a black binding, the last letter there is saying the suspended and charged supply chain manager, Mr. Fizwe Mayaba, subsequently chose to leave the organization of his own accord. It goes on to talk about an agreement to this effect, but what is drawing my attention is when you said with the sole intention to protect the CCMA against any malicious dispute referral. So was this agreement at the expense of Mr. Mayaba's silence? Because now that he has resigned, he was promised that he won't be prosecuted. Is the argument saying he must go and be quiet with the information at his disposal? Because I'm overemphasizing that he has no financial implications. It's not impressing us. It's the information he lives with that is vital to this committee. The second area, Chair, I want to check on the same report. I want to direct the committee to base 10 on the executive summary, the first paragraph, item on the executive summary, which is saying in the tender, CCMAH039, the BEC irregularly planning lies points awarded under functionality in the total points allocation, which changed the outcome of the tender. This was not the first time that there was tender in this situation. Why this oversight? Why didn't you pick it up that it's going to compromise some of the areas as outlined there? Same for page 11, item number 12. Improperly disqualified the bidder who was to benefit out of the improper allocation of the authority disqualification of a bidder from this particular tender. The director, as she was presenting, on several occasions, she mentioned that one person was present in all the colleges, and that was one of the anomalies. Who is this one person? And also, it is indicated here that when it comes to Mr. Mayaba, it seems as if processes were at an advanced stage. But when you look at the slide presentation, it's saying action against other officials involved in procurement is in process. If it's the same deed that they were charged for, why is there an irregularity in terms of processes in their DC cases? Why are these ones still work in progress? Because my understanding is that Mr. Mayaba would only jump after seeing what is coming his way. What then becomes of those ones who are remaining? Then the last one would be to say, in all that has been highlighted, with whom does the
factor? Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I also want to join Honorable Loiwe, and she partly covered me on the question that I wanted to raise. But what is of concern to me is that the director mentioned that they actually were forced to abide by the legal opinion based on the pressure that they receive from the four other bidders. And that made me think that if outside people could see that something is wrong, why did it lead to such a costly exercise for this experienced people to recognize that something big is wrong with this process? That's the first one. And continuously this emphasis we made on there's no money that has been involved in this bidding process, or in this whole process no money was lost. But knowing very well that this thing costed the CCMA almost 3 million rand, if we look at the financial report. When we look at this report on page 11, the executive summary, and we look at point 8. The acting chairperson of the Bid Evaluation Committee meeting of September, Eleanor Hambridge, did not respond to perceived bias uttered by several members of DEC during the formal evaluation of tender. And that was already identified in 2012. So my assumption is that if there was already utterances by several members questioning this process, the process was concluded and signed off by the director in the Industrial Accounting Office, irrespective of all the question marks behind it. I'm just asking. When we look at point 9 of that same page, we would see that there has been two separate submissions for adjudication reports from the same committee, from the same date. Both reports are informed by the CDC meeting on 18 September 2012. Again, there's question marks around the process. But it seems as if the management, they didn't capture it. No red lights flickered on their sides, knowing very well that there has been a lot of question marks regarding this process, which put us in this position at this time of at this conjunction. When we look at point 16, the formal budget was pre-approved for the Western Cape lease tender. The tender was advertised without an approved budget. So my question is just, can you just explain to us that the process, how it usually works, if that is an area of concern with regards to the forensic investigation, or one of the 27 points. So I would like to know if in previous tenders, before the tender goes out, there is an approved budget, and what happened in this instance then. I think if we are going to, on the same report to page 13, Employee Disciplinary and Corrective Action, we see in the first line that the CCMA is finalizing further disciplinary corrective steps against various other employees, which is we know in labor relations terms that we would rather, or labor unions would rather urge that employers should focus on corrective rather than punitive measures. But yet it was so convenient for the main culprit to be released, and that would be seen without any benefits, that would be seen as more punitive than corrective measures. Yet the other employees who was also involved in this thing
It takes very long time to finalize it, but it also is an option of corrective measures rather than punitive stipulated. Can we get an explanation on this issue? And the very last point that I wanted to make is, yes, as Honorable Oliver said, where does the buck stop? And before, I would assume, before putting your signature to any document, you must familiarize yourself, especially when you are the accounting officer, to make sure that at the end, no fingers can point back to you. You must familiarize yourself with the processes that have been taken, if indeed everything is up to scratch. And if nothing, that will happen afterwards. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Madam Director. Thank you for that report. I've got a series of problems that arise out of it. First and foremost, you will recall that when we initially met with you to discuss this issue about the building, you told us that there were no costs incurred at all. Now, that was incorrect. I presume you will agree with me, because you now already spent $3 million. Now, you might not have spent anything on the tenancy, but you've spent $3 million on this, and we'll explore that a little bit later. What I'd like to know is a couple of questions, or more than a couple. The members of the CC of the new company, maybe you can share what their names are, who these individuals are, so you can let us know. And I presume most of it is public knowledge anyway, because it'll be in the High Court, so you can let us know. The next thing is, you spent R1 million on an audit. I'd like to know who did the audit, how much they charged per hour, which consultants or auditors did you use to actually incur R1 million on it. The next thing is, you spent R700,000 on a disciplinary hearing. Which consultant was that, and how much did they charge per hour? Because you've now got a few disciplinary hearings coming up. I've never heard anything so ridiculous in my life for someone to spend R700,000 on a disciplinary inquiry. It sounds almost laughable, but unfortunately it's not the taxpayer's bank. And I presume you'll get some costs back eventually, and we'll explore that a little bit later. Obviously, it begs the question, why did you get the wrong bid in the first place? What actually went wrong? Tell us what actually the mistake was. You can't just get a wrong bidder. After an audit tells you that you got the wrong bidder, how did you do it? And as our Honourable Chair said, this is not the first time you've had bidding processes take place. It appears that you haven't claimed damages against anyone. That's also ludicrous. Someone's got to be responsible for all these costs that you've incurred. You're starting off with $3 million. We'll explore just now in one of my questions how much you're going to spend, because the case has just begun. And that's when real costs start adding up, when you go to the High Court. So the $3 million is just a taste of where we're going. The suspension. You suspended this individual. How many months was he actually suspended? Did he receive his salary during that time, and have you claimed any damages against him? Because that sounds ridiculous, but we keep hearing it. We keep hearing that organs of state suspend people for months on end, pay them their full salary, and somehow nothing actually happens. Which of course begs the question, which I think it was Honorable von Stelkwe alluded to, and that is, we're going to still take disciplinary action against others. We've waited a year now, and maybe someone should have thought about it, or about all the others that were involved in this case. They've been happily carrying on earning salary all that time, and they might be just as culpable as the individual in the first place. And then there was some question about whether the individual could resign or not. I mean, you know, as well as everyone else knows, and we've heard it from you, and it's a unilateral action. Why even get advice on it? Once a person resigns, they resign, they walk out. There's nothing you can do about it. You are the CCMA, after all, you should know about this. it's mind-boggling. The other thing is, you say you've reviewed the internal controls and you have a list of recommendations, it would be useful for us to have a sight into that list of recommendations. You don't seem to put in your report yet. Let us have a look in. We're supposed to be an oversight body, but everything's been held back from us. When we first got your report, nothing about any of this was even told to us. The other thing is, and maybe our chair lady should also have the actual audit report. Maybe you should supply it to her, whether it's an electronic form or on a disk or something, but at least our chair lady, I know it might be voluminous, I hope it's voluminous, because you spent R1 million on it. But if you've spent R1 million, it's gone, it's over, let at least our chair lady have a look at it so that she can decide whether she wants to distribute it to the rest of the committee. Which then brings me to the R3 million. As I said, there was a lovely song that it has only just begun. You're going to spend at least another R3 million if you're going to continue with this litigation. Maybe you have some idea. Have you got a budget? Have you got ideas of what's going to happen? And then, shouldn't you amend your papers and start claiming from people? Start getting money back. This is really ridiculous. I have a whole lot of others, but I'm one of them, the Consul's Sankey Manager.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My colleague and my other colleagues have sort of covered some of the aspects I wanted to raise. But just a few questions I'd like to raise, Chairman, and that is with regard to cost, and there doesn't seem to be an urgency on the part of the GCMA to recover any cost from anybody. That happily allowed the supply chain manager to resign and walk away, knowing full well that a cross order was made against him in labor court, and yet there was no attempt to recover the cost from the supply chain management. Some sort of motivation is given as to why this does not suit, but I don't think that motivation is adequate because it's also stated that the supply chain management walked away with his last on salary and all statutory payments that were due to him. And part of the statutory payments is his pension, and it could have recovered costs from the pension. Why didn't they do it? And secondly, Madam Chair, assuming the High Court application, which is the expectation that it will set aside or nullify the erroneous award tender, all these agreements, what is the status of the other full bidders who were unsuccessful as a result of the erroneously or faulty process that was followed? Furthermore, Madam Chair, if it is considered to restart the bidding process, how long is this going to take? Because there's no clarity as to when this process will conclude. And that brings the question as to possibly answered by the Director as to conclusion of the current lease agreement on the 15th of November, what happened then, because it seems as if, you know, the Western Cape office will be in limbo. Are there any contingency plans being sort of considered now as to what will happen on the 15th, on the 16th of November? Because we place ourselves in a very invidious position in the sense that the current lease holder of the building in Darling Street will know that the system is in this desperate need of accommodation and simply just on a month-to-month basis have a huge escalation in the current rental. So sort of contingency plans need to be made as from today or as soon as possible. Let's walk on our Madam Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you to the CGMA. At least we've got a detailed report, which often we don't get. We get often just generalizations, but I do have some very serious questions. We see the company Otloco, which is actually the company Milestone, and I think I agree with my colleague, we need to know who the shareholders of the company are. Secondly, I see a company called Grand Parade Investments. Could you please explain who Grand Parade Investments is and whether they fit in, because I'm not quite clear in my mind. I think Podlaco and Milestone are the same company with a new name, but who is Grand Parade Investments? Could you just explain that? Mr. Muyaba is, I understand, this area is designed. I understand from listening that he was also the person who sat on all these different committees. If you can just clarify that I'm correct about that, because there's one guy who's now planned this whole thing and executed it by clearly making sure that he followed the whole process through to make sure that a certain outcome was achieved. Can I see a reference to Eleanor Humphreys? Let's just explain who she is in the whole process. Kim, you know, my concern about this is that you have one official, maybe with some others cooperating, who makes sure that a certain bidder gets released. Now, this is just typical of the corruption we see across government. When someone on the inside is working with someone on the outside to secure a certain outcome, in your investigations, have you reason to suspect that Mr. Ayaba is in cahoots with one or multiple partners of Portago or Master Property Group? Because let's face it, you don't influence the outcome of a process to favor a particular client with a massive contract if there's nothing in it for you, because you ruin your reputation when people find out. You only take that risk when there's something in it for you. So there was obviously going to be something in it for Mr. Moyaba. And that something in it was going to be paid, if I understand this document correctly, by someone associated with Portlaco or Milestone Property Group. You know, now I'm allowed to ask these questions because this is a protection of Parliament, yeah, and I'm allowed to dig as deep as I jolly well want to. And I want to. For once, I actually want to know what the connection is between Moyaba and Portlaco. And if you have any information, I want you to please give it to us on the record. What have you found out? And secondly, the other officials involved here, are they part of an orchestrated, in your view, are they part of an orchestrated attempt to deceive the CMA into signing this very unacceptable lease? And if so, what do you intend to do with those individuals? This man wasn't fired. He resigned and went away. I agree finally with my colleague over there and some of the other NC colleagues that 2.8 million rand is gone and some more is going to be spent. And we would like to see somebody sued for their money. Why isn't Mr. Moyaba being asked to pay back the legal fees that have been wasted in collecting this attempted corruption that he was busy with, and maybe others that are involved here? They attempted to sign a corrupt deal, and they were caught out because someone in the organization realized eventually that this was not okay. So they were caught out, and he quietly went away. Why is he or others associated with this not being sued? And finally, Portlaco or Milestone, whatever they called, have not, they're harsh in breach of contract. They're in breach of contract because they couldn't produce the building on the occupation date under the conditions they were required to give it to you. That's breach of contract. Secondly, by selling the building before the court has made a decision, they're a second time in breach of contract. So actually, they are partly also costing you money if your lease runs out in November and you're then on the street. So in fact, instead of them coming after you to perform their lease, you should be going after them for damages that you may suffer because they have twice been in breach of that contract. The building was unfit for human habitation. They couldn't produce occupation certificates. There were things wrong with the building. The access was a problem. And now they've sold the building. So they've completely broken their contract. There's no possible way you're going to be able to go into that building ever. Even if the court does not uphold your request, you still can't fulfill the lease and you still can't occupy the building. So there's no way that you will be required to perform on that lease. It's impossible. It's physically impossible. They are in breach of contract. So there are two parties here that have wronged government and the taxpayer. The one is your staff who have been who've left, or who may still, some of whom may still be in your employ, and this portfolio of milestone profit group. Both have actually cost the taxpayer money, and we know how much that is. So far, 2.8 million, and as my colleague says, more to come. What steps will you take to go after staff who've left, staff who are still in employment, and portfolio slash milestone properties to recruit at least some of the costs that have been weighted, because we need to teach people a lesson that when you try to defraud the taxpayer, we're not going to give you a golden handshake. We're not going to send you to a sunny island somewhere. We're going to put you in jails. That's what I would like to see. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Just to add to
I'm going to ask the questions together with the colleagues that I have here in relation to that chair.
Okay. As you know, I'm not asking any questions yet, hoping that some questions that I have will be clarified in the process of assessing a responding to the questions. However, I want you to clarify, because I don't think that's clear. Just tell me who appoints these committees. Data participation, evaluation, and what's the other one? The one that's awarding tender.
The bid specification committee, the bid evaluation committee, and the bid education committee.
All of them, who appoints them, and do they have people are chairing, formal people that are appointed to be chairing, and who are those? So that's what I would ask.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start at the beginning of the question. Thank you, Chair. Chair, the first question was raised by the Honourable Lady Yuen. I'm going to answer in the beginning, and then I'm going to ask the CFO to answer technical questions in relation to the finance questions and points that were ordered. And in relation to that, some of the questions might overlap, but we'll try and ask them in English. The question that was asked was in relation to the emphasis that was given in the individual leaving the CKMA. Just for clarity, let me start up front. The forensic audit report essentially indicates that there's one main person who's involved in the process, and that was the supply chain manager. And that's on advice given by independent people to the organization and me as the accounting officer. And hence, that is why the initial disciplinary process began with that individual. But there has been rolling out disciplinary action taken from September last year against other individuals or people being called to account, as I indicated in relation to that. I think what's important to remember is that the person who we're talking about, supply chain manager, Mr. Mialba, is a technical advisor to the organization, the person who's considered to have the technical expertise, who should be advising the accounting officer, the CFO, the legal department, whatever, in relation to that. And that is why the role of the individual is so significant in the process, and the officials that support him also in that case. So, while, yes, one understands the concern about the individual being allowed to resign, the individual was suspended, disciplinary proceedings started, the case proceeded for a period of time. The process was then around, could there be found a solution to the matter? The head of legal will take us further in relation to that, but obviously balancing the context of, as everybody said, the costs have only just begun. That if an individual then offers to resign and walk away from the process and not pursuing any of the other cases, bearing in mind that we had a disciplinary process and it could also go through the CKMA processes itself and labour courts, etc., We also, in the end, make the decision which is in the best interest of the organization insofar as the cost implication is concerned. And that is why that process would have been considered. And I think somebody asked, but at the direction of the chair, around why was it consultant? Well, exactly the reasons that are being raised here, that obviously allowing an individual to resign has implications going forward. But it certainly doesn't mean that if there are further malicious intent that comes out, that they're indemnified from that process. I'm going to ask the CMO to deal with the question that was dealing with the tender points on page 10 and page 11 as well, about if it's improper to qualify individuals.
Thank you, Teresa. The question about the first one about BEC points or the function points, if I understood correctly, was that this is not the first time that they're awarding, so how come this happened? Without going to detail it from a technical point of view, is the issue around the incorrect calculation arose as a result of the new Act, the PPPFA, which was promulgated in December 2011. Now, what happened is that with this new Act, it indicated how this calculation should be done. And so coming from this, the audit by the Auditor General the following day, which was then the year ending 2013, when the auditor says the usual, they picked up that we had not applied this calculation correctly, to the functionality was not applied correctly. This was not limited only to this particular list, the case on this. There were other products that were awarded also not following the correct calculation. So as a result, we had discussions with the agency to say that this was the new laws or the issues around implementation, or if there was a possible issue around incorrect interpretation of how the scoring should be calculated. But as it stands, if we refer to our financial statements for the year ending 2013, it is one of the findings that we had from the Auditor General. The next step that we had to look at was that we sought, because of the issue around interpretation or misinterpretation since what the new Act, as I indicated just in 2011, there were also other entities that had not applied or misinterpreted the calculation of this functionality. So as such, we then sought legal opinion to see how this could have happened, because in terms of the National Treasury, it states that if you have an irregular expenditure, you need to take action against the personal investigation to how that expenditure arose. So the opinion that we had, legal opinion, indicated that based on the information that they had and the investigation that they did, the miscalculation that was done was as a result of the Act was still new, and also there were other entities that had calculated incorrectly. As such, then going forward, we ensure that for all the terms on the contract subsequent to that are calculated correctly. So that's how this matter arose, and that is how it was then addressed.
What was the did you calculate exactly? Or you can explain to us what is the calculation, what is this new law saying in terms of calculation, and what is that you did not do right?
Thank you, Chair. The new law is saying that when you award, when you evaluate the tender that is over a million rand, you need to use the calculation of 90-10. And the 90-10 says that you need to look at the functionality points, and the functionality point has a number of issues that include the BEE score. The first point is the time that people perform the work, and then the balance after establishing that, then you look at the price, meaning you would award to the price, to the bidder who had the lowest price. What this differentiating the law that was submitted in 2011 is that after establishing functionality, and the functionality is actually looking at can the people do the job, and in ascertaining whether can the people do the job, you say my minimum score in establishing whether these people can or can't do the job is that they must get at least, let's say, 80% is set a target. So after whatever, when you check to say have they done this point according to the criteria that you have, you'll be scoring them against that say target of 80. And anyone that is below the 80%, which was your target, would not go through in terms of the evaluation or the processing. And anyone that scores above that 80, that's what you would consider. After establishing the functionality, which is whether can the people do the job or not based on the points that they have received, you must discard, that's what the law says, you must discard or ignore whatever points that they have and purely evaluate them on the price. The error that then happened was that instead of the BEAT evaluation committee to discard those scoring that had come from functionality, they then added it to the points that the supplier gets. Now, as a result, then the numbers get inflated because you're having a score that comes from functionality since you're supposed to decide, but then you then add to the issue of the price, and then as a global sum, then you get a total figure. So instead of only looking at the price, after establishing that you have the people can do the job, then you are not supposed to add the functionality. I do understand and we apologize the matter that has been raised that we should have been having support for those who are talking about voluntary support because we could be referring actually to the exact page to that matter. So in terms of the report, then what... I was answering the question to say, as a result then of the adding the issue about the... if we had not added the functionality point, a different bidder would have gotten, would have won the bid, not the one that actually won the bid. That was the crux of the whole calculation. That is, as a result of including information that you should not include it, then someone else and stated in terms of the bid that you had, who could have based on the correct calculation.
I hear what you're saying, but even if we don't have that law, the details of that law in front of us, from what you are saying, it's very simple. It's very, very simple. There is nothing difficult. So I think I'm sure the members understand that. You can't add something that we are not supposed to be adding, and as a result of adding, then someone gets something that is not supposed to get, and take that as a simple error.
Let's see what goes on. Thank you, Chair. Then continue on the questions that were asked. The question was if the director member was individual, and the question was who was that in effort. But that is the supply chain manager, as Mr. Yalva, in relation to the process that I've explained. And that as a result of that, to take the process through. And that's on the advice from the forensic audit process, and the forensic audit process indicated to me that process had been influenced in relation to that. But then the question followed that why is the side service other side process? The reason being is that there are a whole lot of disciplinary processes that have taken place, action has been taken, corrective action, warnings given, or whatever it is, but there are two or three that are still outstanding, so that's why we said it's all in process. To cover the whole process in relation to that, and there's a detailed spreadsheet in relation to how that operates. And I think that we could also disclose that if people needed to see it, but we didn't put it up in relation to the process because some of it's still in progress, and there's evidence that happened with that. I think the key question that keeps being asked is in relation to who's the accompanying, where does the buck stop? The process is simply that as the accounts officer, one awards the bid, and as I've indicated, that you are, then I have made application to court in the capacity of the accounting officer to have that bid set aside. In awarding of a bid, you are given documentation and you are made, and warrants are made to you by senior management or people in those bids who you've employed to assist you. So essentially a submission would be made to the accounts officer, which indicates that the bid committees have sent correctly and the process has been correctly followed. This would be made under the warrant of the fact that the chairs of the individual committees warrant that to you, the legal department warrants to you, the supply chain manager warrants it to you, the chief financial officer has also warranted it to you. And in addition to that, arising out of other challenges that happened publicly at the time of this award, you will also oblige to ask your internal audit department to audit the process and warrant to you as the accounting officer that there were no challenges with the processes, I think I've mentioned earlier. In this case, there had been a few challenges which had then been rectified, which the internal auditor verified. And then following on from this, on top of that, the Auditor General in the year under review, not the one that, but the previous one, had also audited the process. And then other than the issue that has just been explained by the Chief Financial Officer, which they found that audit to be acceptable, that warranted as well that the process has been correctly followed. So as the accounting officer, you then make a decision based on the representations of all those individuals who are paid to ensure that the processes are followed correctly, and then you would then assign an award based on that. And so in that case, as the accounting officer myself, I'm obliged to ensure that I have, as the accounting officer, in the terms of the PFMA, correctly qualified legal staff, correctly qualified financial staff, and correctly established committees in relation to it, which at the time had been the case. So essentially, the accounting officer were put into the governing body and then ultimately into the Department of Labour would be responsible. Moving on then to the next question from Honourable von Trollbeck. I think that perhaps in the presentation that I made...
On a point of order, Madam Chair, would it be appropriate just to pursue or to respond to the answer that the Director stated? It would be quite easy to understand, to accept an explanation like that in terms of, at the end of the day, there are senior people who have been employed to provide expert advice regarding particular contracts, people that with judgment the director would not question. So we have two of those people here. We have a chief financial officer here, we have the chief of legal services here, who were party to the particular process in terms of recommending to the accounting officer that this release should be signed. And one thing that worries me, Madam Chair, is that it was only discovered in March 2014 when so-called red flags went up that there are problems with this particular lease. But at that stage, the lease had been already been signed by all of us concerned. And only from then onwards, a forensic investigation was launched and the process to challenge the validity of the lease was set in motion. So, yes, the supply chain manager, he's, by virtue of his actions, he may be guilty of certain irregularities, etc. But there are many other people who are also indirectly guilty of the dereliction of duty, of not ensuring that the lease that was signed by the account officer is in compliance with the act as stated by the CFO. Thank you.
Can I just let you go along, or I guess I don't stop.
You want to respond to that?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. In light of the director that she has explained in terms of how the process reached before the awarding is done, I just want to just provide clarity that it is not the CFO or the head of legal that recommends that the tender be awarded. It is the bid committees that is the question of saying who appoints the bid committee that the director would have put in place, which is in line with the PFMA that the accounting authority to ensure that there are bid committees there. That's fine, that's according to the policy, the PFMA. So what then happened is that the bid adjudication committee is the authority body in any other organization that makes a recommendation to the accounting officer to award the tender. So I think that's the part that I need to clarify, that it is the bid adjudication committee that makes the recommendation to the accounting officer for the awarding of the tender. Thank you.
I think that is clear, and
if I'm not wrong, you correct if I'm wrong. Because that's the question that I think the director answered it. Who formulates this contingency? Yeah, that she does. And they report to the director directly after any after this committee, every information that gets the director, they interact with the director directly.
I think that I need to clarify an issue. The committees don't interact with directors directly because directors cannot be seen in any way to interaction with them because the award is the independence. So you have to be removed from the process or you can't be involved in the process because you have to find the ultimate award in relation to that, just for clarity.
No, I understand that, but they report to the director. But at the end of the day, the director has to sign or the director can reject. The processes that are going on in those committees, the fact that the director or the accounting officer is not there, it does not say that the director must okay everything that goes there because the director himself or herself has to check those processes. If they are right, I don't believe that we can have an accounting officer who will just sign everything that is brought in front of him or her and sign it off. That's what I'm saying. I know that you are not practically there, but the fact that you are represented and those people that are part in those committees are people who are selected because they're not just chosen. They are selected on the basis that they are fit and have capacity to do the job. There is no way that they can put there if the accounting officer knows that they could have shortcomings, whether in calculation or in anything. So that's what I want to bring in front of the committee.
So, Chairperson. My next question raised was in relation to the Honourable von Schlappbeck's question, and that Capstar was misunderstood in relation to the fit. Ismail was forced to provide the legal opinion based on pressure from other businesses. I don't think that we were forced. We were given a legal opinion which was debated, and once one has that legal opinion advising that the committee had incorrectly advised you and that there were other issues that should be considered, one would then have to consider that legal opinion, and if one didn't do anything, one would be seen to be acting in contrary to how the law would be. So, just to clarify, it was one of the considerations, but it wasn't pressure externally at all. But there has been a complaint made because of consideration amongst all other considerations. In making the decision to proceed with the court case. Okay. The next issue that was raised was in relation to the money being lost. I think it's important that we distinguish between the point that the point we're making when we indicate that there's no money lost, what we mean by that is that that there's no money that's been paid to the incorrectly awarded bidder. And that's the point. It's not insofar as the CCMA has incurred expenses, because obviously it has to incur expenses, and sometimes it has to incur expenses because one gets litigated against, and one sometimes incurs expenses because one's litigating. So the issue there is that certainly we've put up and calculated the expenses that have been incurred, either to get proper expert advice or to make sure that we could try and proceed with the project as it may forward. So yes, in agreement in relation to that. I think the questions that followed in were on page 11, which were in relation to the findings of page of 8 to 9 as listed. I think that I need to clarify that those lists, the summary of the report findings, and certainly at the time of the award being given, the director would not know that the individual is referred to, Hambridge, had conducted herself incorrectly as a file or the submissions in relation to that. So that would only came out because the forensic audit was conducted and that the audio of the meeting was listened to in relation to that. So when the documentation was presented to the director by supply chain indicating that all the committees had followed time by the relevant committee members and the process that has been followed, then essentially, in the view of the director, the process of reviewing it, reading it, had been followed correctly. Therefore, you would enter, as the accountant officer, you would then enter into the agreement based on that. These only came out subsequently from that process. And certainly no one else in the committee ever reported that conduct. I'm not sitting in that committee. I wouldn't have any way of knowing that that conduct happened. But I can certainly confirm that the individual has had disciplinary action taken against them, give a final written warning in relation to that, and has been sent on specific training in relation to the process, although initially indicated that they didn't want to continue in the process, but the advice I got from the forensic auditors and the audit general was that they had actually learned a lot. It would be better to keep on the existing people in the committee because they've already got the experience of this process to ensure that they bring it to the organisation. I think that addressing that, I've also addressed the next one, which is around submission process and question marks around the process that there is disciplinary action being taken against very other individuals based on the different levels of the process going forward. I think the next question which was raised was in relation to the budget and the funding of the budget, so I'm going to ask the CFO to address that.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Did the personnel who has been moving from one committee to another, what was he? I hear that they're saying this, with the Mayama, that the person, what are his responsibilities?
Okay, he was the head of supply chain management for the CCMA. So the individual that would have to advise that the process had been followed correctly, the individual would have to have oversight over the whole department in relation to how tenders are set up, advertised, etc., and then reporting to CFO.
So by so doing, he was doing his job. What is that is wrong about him from moving from one country to another? And explain to me, because when you were giving your first input, you said in each committee there should be someone who's doing that responsibility, meaning that Mr. Maya then is an overall person who will have to show. So what is illegal about him moving from committee, one committee to another? Is it because there was someone who has been asked to do that job, or exactly what it is? Is it something that you did not know during that process that Mr. Mayara is moving from committee to another? Is it something that came only after the report?
I'm
asking this question because we need to, we as committee of parliament, if there is a forensic report, definitely that forensic report has come through a lengthy process of interviewing people. So that's a process that we are not, we're not part of. So for us to understand, because all these processes are conducted by people, we need to re-examine and understand. So all I need to know from the accounting officer is that the accounting officer must say there was no need for Mr. Mayaba to move from one committee to another, irrespective of the fact that that is his job. There was no need because there are people that I have assigned to do that job. And Mr. Mayaba had the responsibility, maybe then later, to come to the director and say, just check ABC, something of that nature.
Chair, I think what you're saying actually summarizes it, but the central issue is that the audit finds, in the context of governance, that you shouldn't have the same person in an award as being awarded making presentations to all the committees, because it allows that person to carry through misrepresentations if they've made any. So that you should, out of a supply chain process, have a separate person in the more junior committees, the more senior committees, and that certainly the supply chain manager should have oversight over all of that, but and then also reporting through at the moment to the CMA structure, to the CFO, to the director. And yes, if there were concerns, the supply chain manager did have an obligation to come to the director and tell the director, none of which happened. So at that stage, the committees had individuals who were taking minutes in relation to that, and in some instances it was the supply chain manager himself, and that was not being conducted as required and as was set up. But the individual supply chain manager is responsible for ensuring those committees are correctly convened and are correctly set up, and in that process of making the submission that they're correctly set up. Now, all that was made in the papers which are put before directors because you're not in meetings. So the committee's listed, these are the people, this is the process, this is the minutes, etc. But when you actually evaluate it in detail and listen to the transcript, that's actually not what happened, if I make myself clear. So the individual process was that you would have the specification committee, they would agree on the specification. Supply chain manager was there, then specification process was advertised, then the bid evaluation committee sat and evaluated the bids. Then from the bid evaluation committee into the bid adjudication committee, things were changed by the supply chain manager, so that the people, that the person who originally said the bid evaluation committee and the bid adjudication committee did not sign off the right minutes because the one person was ill on the day, and so the actual chair signed even though they weren't the chair of the meeting, if you understand. And that the content of what the bid evaluation committee discussed was changed when it was the bid adjudication committee. And, okay.
Don't worry. This is very simple. Let's give her. Let's, maybe she wants to read. You want to clarify something, then I'll give it to you another person. Please.
Thank you, Chair. Just if I understand the correct, the question was that what was wrong with those persons going through different head committees, and what was there anything legal from the Act point of view that stopped him or that he was doing what he was not supposed to do? So in answer to that briefly, is that from the PSMA or from the PSMA point of view, there is nothing that stops or that says that cannot happen, that cannot be done. There's nothing that stops the supply chain manager to be in these committees that see the different committees that have been mentioned. And this I'm responding to also in line with what Honorable Lulu had said. She said this is not the first time that we awarded the tender, because in the previous years we've been audited and the AG knew that was the practice, that you either have the supply chain manager in these committees or the assistant supply chain manager are in the show. So it was not per se anything that was fit, or there was anything wrong with the fact that he was involved in providing advice in those different committees. The issue around having different people is an enhanced internal control that says, look, for segregation of duties, it's better to have someone different from one committee to the other. Not necessarily that there's a law that says that cannot happen, but it's just an enhanced internal control that came with this recommendation, which we have implemented to say let's rather have different people. And obviously the reason we're having different people, or how we speak, is that it looks at how tricky the tender is, how complex the tender is, and the different committees per se. There's much work that is done at the bid evaluation committee as compared to the work that is done at the bid specification committee, even in terms of the time they spend, because there's so many things that they evaluate. So what has been the practice that we look at all those, and also when it comes to the bid adjudication committee, the supply chain official who come and make and provide the expert advice to the bid adjudication committee, it must be a senior supply chain official who is knowledgeable in the practice and so forth. So those are the things that we consider in terms of who we place, but there's nothing per se in the Act that says that a single person cannot be in, that it's just an enhanced control that we think is better from the segregation of duties that we do it.
Thanks, Chair. I'm getting confused now. This says nothing wrong with the person sitting in all these protocols. Why is this rate as an anomaly in the current process? Number two, at what age does the accounting officer intervene? Does it mean this is not the last time we are seeing irregularities being committed in the presence of the accounting officer? Because if the accounting officer is indicating that because she's not sitting in those committees, there's no way that she'll know some of these things. Is she only waiting for the product for her to attend the signature? before, after every lap that has been passed, a report is forwarded to her office so that she can be in a position to see whether all processes have been properly followed. Can you be clarified there? And I think my learned friends are meaning to talk to me.
Yeah, no. You, if you need to have to wait for a few seconds to come mm-hmm. to the so that we cannot disturb each other.
Okay.
Okay.
So let me start, and then the CFO will come in as well. Okay. On the direct question that's been asked. But we have the internal audit department. As the accounting officer, you can't be in every single place. So you have to rely on how the system sets up with the segregation of duties, as I said, in terms of governance. And that you have to rely that the people that are appointed there, the people who are the expert advisors there, will conduct themselves according to the process. And you can set up systems that address that with what we have. And then as a result, you rely on that. And then you would then expect the internal audit department to also audit that process and give you what's in audit service called assurance, okay? So they reassure you that yes, as the process is set up, it is conducted accordingly.
Just clarifying or responding to the anomaly regarding the same person. The forensic audit report says that as a result of this one individual or one person being involved in three committees, he could have. So the first part that I just wanted to clarify that it didn't say that there's an act that there was that you've not followed or that you have avoided or did not follow. It's just saying that as an enhanced internal control, rather have different people because if you have the same individual, he could influence the process. So that's the part that I wanted to clarify.
Okay. You see, I'm not sure now whether the CFO and the director are ready from the same page.
Mm.
The director is overemphasizing the presence of this individual in all his processes. The CFO is saying the report is saying could have influenced. You are from the same institution but speaking differently. Which one is the correct version now? Because if I read well what the CFO is saying, the CFO is saying there's no direct link to the presence of this person to the anomalous person. But if you have listened to the director's input, every now and again she'll say the presence of this one person. So it's an issue to the director and another issue to the CFO, which is which?
You know, it is important that we are clear on this because if this person, as it has been projected, I'm a very good listener when someone speaks, or especially when I really want to understand and that I listen. And writing disturbs me, but I keep everything in my head. That this person might have, you know, influenced these processes in favor of a certain leader. That's what I got. In essence, I might not be quoting everybody, but that's what I had. And my worry about this is what Honorable Lolo is raising.
because I would think that when this forensic report, or before you embark on a forensic report, in any case, you all set down and the figures for the director and say, as a result of the ABC, as she has pointed out, you must then go for a forensic report. Now, before you went for a forensic report, did you know, director, that Mr. Mayaba is moving, is doing his normal job of doing an oversight of moving from one committee to another? Because as you were speaking, you also pointed out that he is an advisor to the department and is advising you. As he was advising you during this process, did you pick up that he is moving from one committee to another? And if he did, were you, what then, did you feel uncomfortable with that moving of him? Because I'm coming to exactly what you have said to the committee. Just before we go to the forensic report, but did you know that he is advising, he's doing his oversight, whatever you call it, and did you have a problem with that? He's going to answer, and I'll give you another question. Okay.
If we can just ask the CCMA to clarify, his job was to oversee the process to check that it was done correctly in all these committees. But what in fact we found from the reports is that he was trying to influence the process instead of trying to check that the process is doing correctly or have up something. Is the problem with him that he was trying to influence the process to get a certain outcome? But his job was to be there to check that there was no influence. So he actually did the opposite of his job. Or have I misunderstood?
You want to add on this issue? Yes, another point?
Thank you, Chairperson. All the discussions led to the following thinking. That while he had this person moving from one committee to another, trying to influence and get a preferred outcome, we have established, as the director said, competent committees in place. So my question just arises that whilst we have competent people in these committees who went through this process over and over, because surely they were having other tenders and stuff, they knew their job. But at the end, we found that in this instance, they have been influenced by this specific person. So my question is just, Jay, if they are so competent, how sure are we that they are credible at the end? And that might lead to things, if we could have discovered this thing after the war, tender has been awarded. It might be that maybe in the past or in the future that thing might have happened or can happen again. Thank you.
Okay. Well, whatever your answer is, please don't forget that a Wood wants the director for me to tell me whether you are aware and was she uncomfortable, because if her advisor has where she's arriving to button, so I want to know, in this process, did she know that he is doing his overall job, despite the fact that there are those competent people, as my colleague is saying, in those committees, did she feel uncomfortable as the accountable officer by him moving from one committee to another? and then you can answer. I'm circling on mine that I want mine to be answered, and then you can answer the what should members ask.
There are many questions. I think it's important to start by explaining the structure of how the CCMA operates. And while, yes, the supply chain manager is the advisor to the CCMA in relation to supply chain processes, as the structure of the CCMA is set up, the supply chain department is actually reported to the director through the office of the CFO. So I cannot say to you whether the individual are going to the committees, I have no idea. I don't know a day-to-day level of the work that the individual does, because CCMA is quite a big organization. So I would have to rely, as I've indicated, on the expert advice that I'm getting from the advisors report directly to me. So I can't say whether the individual was going to the committee or not. I didn't know at the time. And it wouldn't have been an issue, it wouldn't have caused me a concern if somebody had raised it with me, because I'm not involved on a day-to-day basis in relation to those committees. Now, I know that it sounds like the director and the CFO are saying different things. I don't think we are saying different things. I think what we're saying is that the forensic audit report indicates to me that the process had potential to be manipulated because the same individual had oversight over those processes. And I think Robert, in this question, has touched on it. And that is that the individual's job is to make sure the process in terms of the PSMA are correctly followed. But in fact, you have to rely ultimately, as the auditors always say to me, on an individual's integrity. And you have to rely on the fact that there's process set up to the best of the ability in terms of how the law is required, and the forensic audit finds that the CCMA has set up their processes correctly, that the committee were correctly established, and they were operating correctly. So I think it's an important point for everybody to, you know, consider in the discussion. But that if there is oversight and a person wishes to deliberately try and influence the process, that it is allowed, it is possible, and it's very difficult to try and prevent that process. Okay. But CFO, I think, wants to elaborate.
No. As you were speaking, you mentioned that that's what I manage, I report to you directly. Not to you directly. So she reports to you through someone else. Now, that someone else, you've stated your point. I don't know if there is anything new. If there is anything new, please go ahead, because we heard you correctly when you said there is nothing wrong, because he is overseeing the work. But with that dismay that there is nothing wrong, when this audit report came and pointed fingers at him in relation to what with him is there is nothing wrong, what then did you say? Because if you came up openly and say, this person did not do anything wrong, in fact, this is a deceit, what we want to know exactly, what, because if he really has that opportunity of moving around, Honorable Oris is right, he might use, it depends, I'm not saying he has done it, I'm saying if he has that opportunity, it's commonly known that he is in a position. But it is human as an individual. He might have people, because if you had competent people that were put in that position, I don't think that you have put people who are back whenever someone is saying. You have put people there who are competent, selected people who are competent. Did you receive a complaint before the forensic report that the presence or the going around of this person in this committee is creating a problem or is influencing a problem to a certain direction? We need to know whether Mr. Mayaba is sitting at us in the Whether is a sacrifice that is in a Kamal Kud, whether he is or indeed he has abused his position. That is very much important because at the end of the day, the bar stops with the accountability. I cannot sit here and then not know what the committee members are doing or not being in a position to answer reject when I have to reject and I say I don't know, or when I know I will say I know. But when it comes, my colleague has come up with something very important, that you will never sign a document without knowing. And as for the accounting officer who has been there for a long time, anything that has to do with tender, it deals with money. And anything that has to do with tender, it's looked by people with, what is that thing, micro? Magnifying glass. You see, it's not looked like this. They go to the minutest of the minutest, so that to see whether this person who has got the tender qualifies. You see, this is something that has to do with people's stomachs, and all those go there, they know each other, they know, and they would want to see whether the process was done in it. So, and as an accounting officer, I put myself in a position where if I put my signature, any question that comes out, that arises out of the flouting, whatever that has to do with it, I will be in a position to answer. Whatever has happened, it is going to say that the accounting officer is going to take the responsibility. But we want to understand at which stage, because it seems as if all these processes that are taking place, you don't see them as a problem. Definitely director sees them as a problem. Director agrees with the report. But it is also not fair that if the director is saying this process did not go right, this person was not right, and you did not inform the director, you will tell us, were you setting up the director, or what is going on?
Thank you, Chair. The main question that I was answering is saying, is there anything in the Act that stops this individual? I'm only referring to this only particular panel with him moving around. And I'm saying that there is no such Act. The forensic report said the person could have, as a result of sitting in the different committees. If I may just briefly quote, it says, although there appears to be adequate segregation of duties relating to the CMA tender processes, we have found that any tender can be substantially influenced by a single individual. So that's the part that I was referring to in terms of can or could. Now, in terms of my role as a CFO and the supply chain man that reported to me in addressing the question whether there were there any complaints that were raised today that this person could be or is actually influencing the process, there was no complaint whatsoever that was brought to my attention. In fact, referring to the point that the director has mentioned around the credible or qualified competent composition of these committees, in each of the committees, over and above the members that you have and the chairpersons that you have, we had a risk officer and an internal audit officer who sit as observers of the process. So that was like an added control, internal control that we had, that not only the supply chain manager or official and the members, but they were observers in the process. So in each of these committees, the bid verification committee, the bid evaluation committee, and the bid adjudication committee, we had an internal audit official and risk management official who were observing that, and of those officials that sat in those committees, there was never any report or made to myself or to the director to say we had concerns based on us attending this meeting. These are the things that we have observed, which did not follow the process. That did not happen. And then again, referring to the fact that this was not the first tender that you awarded a contract, even in the past, the same supply chain manager would be in either both or all three or one of them, and there was never a finding coming from the AG to say there was some anomaly with regards to that. It was just an enhanced control that we have now implemented, that we should not have a separate supply chain official as an additional or enhanced internal control.
I'm satisfied. I'm sure the question then will come back with the department or the entity will answer the question when it comes. Why did we see it to speed up the process of one, not many? Is it because of that paragraph that has been quoted to us? Because it's clear from what is being said is that at no stage that there were suspicions or there were dissatisfactions or rumors that were going around that say this person and in fact is influencing the process in a certain direction. And in fact, we are hearing that these processes have been taking place in this same manner. It is not a new thing. And then why would the company see it fit to go for one person? Because on legal basis, this paragraph that we have read, it is not saying he has done it or she has done it. And you are saying it's your modus operandi in the company whenever you are dealing with the tenders. Now you have to tell us why in this instance that you saw it fit, that then the fingers must be pointed to that person who has been doing something in the company, who was never told by the company that what you are doing is not in line. Why did we run for him and the others you assist in the process? Another question.
Thanks, Chairperson. I was concerned that our other question hadn't been answered. We were coming down the line and we got so far and we focused on one question, but can we get the other ones also, please, because we want to know.
No, it's important, Honourable Audience, because this is an individual, as we said, who led us to be here today, who led to the whole thing to be reviewed. This is an individual that we would term has abused his position and move around and give the tender, because it is said by us to set it up. So it's I think we are dealing here with the main issue, because after this fine will answer them. So it's important for us that we spend time so that we don't victimize people unnecessarily. I'm not saying it's victimized, but we are asking questions to find out why it was necessary.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the question. Thank you, it's been very helpful.
I'm interested, and then we can pass over. I misunderstood
you. I thought you said at the end you want to make sure that I've addressed that question. I'm sorry, apologies. We focused in the discussion on the one finding, which is an interesting finding, which influences all the other issues, but that's not the only finding that the forensic audit finds against the supply chain manager. There are a host of other findings in relation to that. And just to remind everybody, as the accounting officer, you wouldn't just sit in your office on your own and decide to take disciplinary action against somebody. In fact, it would be very rare that you do that. You would have to have recommendations made to you by the senior management, you know, up the line of the chain of command. So I'm going to hand to you both the CFO and the the financial, sorry, the legal, because what he did in the process, and then it said I actually don't advise him, so they take you through the advice.
It will be important to go back. As we answer, it will be important to see whether this person has been victimized, because the worry is that there are other issues that really are not, you know, the people who are still in the system, and it's almost a year, you know, but they are still there. So it's clear that whatever, there is something that has in the discussion, you are saying, you are not sitting alone in the office. In the discussion that you had, when it comes to report, all the anomalies, all the wrongdoing pointed in one person, and the rest really are not something that is not that important, something that you can deal with. So as you, I'm sure that question is going to be answered to why are you taking, I'm not sure if it has been answered. Because if it has not been answered, then we'll then go into details. Remember that I still want these people to be named who were in this committee. And these people that you are on DC is in process, they also need to be named. And you must tell us why your process with others is not so quick.
So I'm going to start with the following. When the forensic auditors finally asked to meet with me to give me the outcome of the reports of their meeting with the other members of staff, because the accounting officer, the opening sentence was, as the accounting officer, you have been let down by your supply chain department, by the bid committee, by the finance department, by your legal department, and that everybody has made recommendations to you based on that process. And then up the process, it got exacerbated. So that's the reason why there was a stop in relation to that. But I think that what's coming across is that there's other, not the other disciplinary action against individuals, that's not the case. It has been other disciplinary action. But the issue that came through was that the supply chain manager in the process had been the person who was most, had erred in so many ways. And I think that the CFO just take you through all the issues and all the findings in relation to that. It wasn't only one issue that we're talking about, which was sitting on the committee, but there were others. But that is certainly an interesting process, because it creates the impression that, as I said, that you could either you don't know how to do your job because you're supposed to have oversight in the process, or you're deliberately manipulating it for your own personal gain, and that is obviously of concern. So that's partly why we've emphasized it, that there were certainly other findings in relation to the technical advice, the process that's been followed, the calculating functionality, etc., that the supply chain manager would also find not to follow through directly. And I'll see if I just take through in relation to that.
Thanks, Marika. As indicated by the director, there were the reason why Tuesday was suspended and the charges brought against him were not only limited to the one aspect of him going to different committees. And but one of the things also I'm just quickly referring to what we had on the charges, it referred to issues whereby he placed an added sort of cancellation, the change of specification that happened without following the policy, which stated that there needs to be authorization before the specification can change. So that is right, or is true, that he should have adhered to the policy with regards to getting authority before the spec could be changed. And also regarding the following of the policy in terms of the calculation and the functionality point, so those are the aspects that we're saying that, yes, the issue was that the policy was not followed, so the charges against him were around negligence, in the sense that for his role as a supply chain manager, this is what the policy stated, and it was negligent that it did not come out. So, I mean, if I may just quickly go back to what you had raised initially to say that are we saying that there's nothing wrong that supply chain manager did? I'm not saying that there's nothing wrong. There are certain aspects which was expected of him to have done, and he did not do. For those ones, those are the ones that he was then from the coming from the charges that he was negligent, he should have conducted that. So that's the input, because you know the process, but you sit with the human resource department and say, here's an issue, how do you go about it? But as she indicated, I'm a finance specialist, the ARA matters, disciplinary matters, I would also get advice, how do you go about it? So, yeah.
At what stage did you know that the sex has been changed? When they are our shrines or shrines at the end, as a personal report to you?
Since this is a big process, it's a big process. The process of a big are a little bit different from the operational matters. So on the operational matters, directly you say to me, this needs to be done with director, because I should say, why did you not do it? And with regards to the bid process, the specification in terms of our policy needed to be approved by the senior authorities in the organization. And when he changed the specification, he made a submission straight to the tender that was advertised. Again, for clarity, there was nothing wrong for him to make the advertisement. What was wrong was that when spec changed, he should have gotten authorization to change the spec before advertising it. And at the time, when everything was going well, they of the impression that everything was followed the steps, that what we had on the advert or the tender bulletin was exactly what was approved.
Saying to ask that you did not, no one in the corporate organization saw that this step happened until the audit, the forensic audit. So this committee started working on wrong steps from the beginning, and no one could detect that. And when the update was out, no one could detect that. Director could not detect it. Yourself, you could not detect it. I'm saying yourself because that person reports to you. No one could see until the forensic report.
Chair, if I may answer, at the time of when the advert is out, it has already gone past the specification. Sorry, the different committees. So the bid adjudication committee would have already awarded the tender at that particular time. But if you may just maybe give me a second, I just want to refer to that particular finding in making sure that I've addressed your concerns correctly.
Chair, I think the chair was looking for that information, and I mean, the member who was the British Adjudication Committee chair also present, so could have maybe assist. Obviously, I'm not there. But in my understanding of the finding of the forensic audit, exactly what you're saying is correct, is that there were specifications made, and the British Adjudication Committee set those specifications, and then an advertisement was made, and then they were changed unilaterally without permission by the supply chain manager and re-advertised. Now, certainly, there should have been oversight, and there should have been checked, but it didn't happen, and that's also part of the disciplinary ongoing process with the other committees, as I understand.
Okay. No, I don't. I think I hear what the director is saying, because we must not defend ourselves. If we were irresponsible in the process, we must not say this. So I don't believe that for a second that one person, it's fine, he can do it, he has done it. But no one could detect it. And no alarm was made that is under. You never saw it. There is something very wrong. There's something very wrong. I think your answer, director, is adequate, because if you agree that you did not see it, because there are other people who should have seen it, all of you should have seen it, this is not what you have agreed upon, or this is not what was presented. So until it goes to people who are doing this thing outside, that's the only time. So please,
I then proceed to the next set of questions.
You wanted to say something. Unless what you are going to read is going to justify why
no one could not see this thing, then you can read. If it's not saying that, I don't think I'm really want to hear it. If no one, if it's possible that that could have been done without no one detected. Okay. It's good.
I'm referring to the audit report, the forensic audit report, and obviously the way interviews that the forensic auditors conducted during the course of the process. And I'm just reading from the paragraph. It says, during formal interviews, members of the BEC indicated that they were unaware of the change of the specification of the tender. And even the user department also, when being interviewed, officials representing the user department advised that they learned of the change in the specification informally after the event and that they had not been consulted. So they also did not know about that. Now, what the closing part, which probably addresses the issue, says that when the BEC submitted its report, the Bid Evaluation Committee submitted its report to the Bid Adjudication Report, the title had changed. The title under project description, which makes you aware what project or which tender are you specifically referring to, had changed. It usually saying within KPIs and not on the official title of the tender itself, that the issue about the 10T. So maybe it would have been important to clarify what exactly changed, because then it would bring clarity whether a reasonable man would have been expected to see the change in the spec. The initial spec set is that the award that you're looking for, or the tender that you're offering, is a 10T, which means all inclusive, not only the parking and the building, but it will include the cleaning services, the security services, and so forth. So that's a 10T. Now, that's the tender that was issued out. The change of the tender was no longer being 10T. It's still to any reasonable person who was brought before them, who was brought before the BACU, it was saying Western Cape lease. And we know that we are really dealing with the Western Cape lease. The cycle, the subtle change that it's 10T was not on the heading or the project name. That's the reason that even the forensic court has confirmed that a reasonable person would not have known, because it still came as the same tender. So what should have done, what should have happened is that as the initial tender was saying Western Cape lease in inverted format 10T, then the second one should have then come as Western Cape lease 10T or excluding the part of 10T. So that one word actually changed the whole thing, which reasonably one could not have picked up.
I want to explain just a few things for clarity, so, because the questions keep coming back. How did the CMA or the Executive Committee come to know that there was something wrong? There was no complaint. There was no grievance lodged. Everything looked normal, like you would do all other tender processes. And so, I may be speaking to the converted, but please grant me the answer to explain this part about committees, because I think that's where the rupture happens. As you would have heard when the director explained that we have three committees, right? And in that order, I just want to show you also what has changed since then as a result of this investigation. So on the 1st of March 2014, we had expected that we would enter that building, everything's fine. But it became evident that all is not well. Why can't this be delivered? Exactly what was agreed when the successful bidder said, but on what we are doing, you should pay extra because that's what we agreed. We go to the documents, we check on the documents, but there is no such an agreement. Now, your supply chain manager had undertaken the following. We check on the legacy committee, what undertaking are being referred to, and we can't find. Then we realize that, therefore, in order for us to understand our holistic, what is going on, let's invest that. That was the best thing that we could have done. There was nothing else. Because it would be uncommon for the executive committee to engage with the bid specification committee, to engage with the BEC or the BEC at any stage until the awarding is made by the bid adjudication committee. So let me explain this process because it is extremely important. I will also answer the question that was asked about who Eleanor Hambridge, that was asked by Honourable Member here. So in the bid specification commission, what is expected to be done, and that's all that is expected to be done, deadlock the specification as requested by the end user. Give us the specification. So the committee is constituted by the director of CCMA. She appoints the chairperson of the committee and the members. All its mandate and what it must do is to do the specifications. And that's what this committee did. Now, subsequent to that, now dealing with the question of the change of the specification, which is material manager, the specification of the bid can never be changed without being endorsed, first by the executive committee, secondly by the bid specification committee that made the original specifications. It's wrong. It's irregular if that happens. In this case, that's what happened. But at the time that the specification was changed, because they were not reported to the committee that was dealing with the specification, it could not be picked up. So when the advert is made, then the CFO might explain how you manage the process, but the supply chain manager, in as far as ensuring that all the decisions that are made in the different committees are implemented and agreed, he carries that expertise and the knowledge on how it's done. It is his responsibility, together with the team that reports to him. So the idea of could have influence gains momentum if the supply chain measure changes the specification without following due process. So the question that must follow, why would you do that when you know what the process is doing? We must explain that. So, and what is material about this change, Madam Chair, is not just a question of process, because it has material consequences, one of which is the following. Let me explain. Firstly, when you say turnkey, if turnkey is what is your original spec, it means the person who wants to bid, those who do not have the competency or the financial capacity to meet the turnkey requirements will not bid. So it is a financial exclusion. So somebody who is weaker but who's got only parking, who's got only the office space, will say, well, I'm expected to provide security, I'm supposed to be cleaning all of that, which are the constituent party. So I cannot afford to underpay. So those who have the financial strength and the capacity and the property to provide, they're the best. So that's why it is important that if you have agreed, as we did, that we have a certification, any change that must be done, it must go back to that committee and be properly advertised. So that those now who could not afford initially got to the 10 key, now it's not the 10 key, so that the standards are left, now they can bid. So if you don't do that, you go back to exactly what I said earlier on, that the section 217 requirements of fair process, of proper competitive bidding, is completely frustrated by that. So I can assure you, had the executive committee of the CCMA been aware that there was an irregular change of the specification, it would have acted. The only reason why it did not act before that time, because it was not aware of such a change. Because you are caught, you assign that specific responsibility of management to the supply chain manager and his team. The CFO, for example, if she's not informed about such a change, she can't pick it up. Because as it is advertised, it is advertised and it is expected that at the place on a specification that was done at the committee. That is the expectation. Any person with an evil motive, anyone who would change it for other motives other than those that we affect as an organization, they can do so as they have a debt. But eventually when we pick up that from the investigation report, then we ask the question, please explain. And the explanation is, well, in terms of the bid document, it says I have the power to change. The answer is, no, you don't. That's why we're charging you for that. So the financial implication of the TNT is quite critical. Now, here's the second part again. The participation of supply chain management. I mean, saying management, Madam Chair, not necessarily dealing with CISO as the chairperson, but the entire team. Because if CISO is not able to attend, then the system manager must attend, or any person must attend. It is not because we want to constitute the forum. It is because the expertise of advice is important in each and every one of those committees. Because the members that have been selected to participate in those committees are not experts, really. But they are expected. That's why the prerequisite is that once you become a member of any of those committees, you must be trained on all the principles of supply chain management. Because you must have the working knowledge on how to deal with the function, including your role if you're a chairperson or just an ordinary member. This applies right across.
So now, what then happens to that person? The customer is having that information. So once the certifications are done, it is the duty of the chairperson of that committee to look at the minutes, look at what was agreed, you sign off what was agreed, and then it feeds into the next stage. It doesn't come to EXCO. It doesn't come to the CFO, because that's the wrong process. That will be irregular and it will be against policy. Policy says, once the certification committee has spoken, go to the evaluation. Now the evaluation, that was the Eleanor Hamrich question that came up. Because Eleanor Hamrich was the acting chairperson on the day when this certification was approved. The chairperson who is, in fact, the chairperson of that committee was not the one presiding on the day. She was the excellent chairperson of the bid evaluation committee. So when they see the specification, they look at the minutes, they look at it has been signed off. So now, let us now evaluate based on BEE, based on price, based on functionality. Now, here comes the role again of the supply chain manager. So we sit there and say, okay, so how does the 90-10 work? Is this a 10G? Yes. So that's fine. So when we allocate points, we are allocating in terms of the regulation. If at that time, the regulations that are being used to calculate are wrong, the supply chain manager must advise the committee. No calculation as you do it here is not correct, because there's been a change in the regulation. This is the new method and the new form. So in other words, over the vibe of being trained as a member of the committee, you are expected from time to time to keep yourself abreast of the change that has to go. If there's any section in law or organ of state, where regulations change almost every day, it is a treasury regulation. So you need to keep track of that. Because if you don't do that, you are applying a wrong formula, which will then eventually give you a wrong finding. This is what happened here. So the evaluation committee said, and among other problems said that in the minutes issue, I'll explain it between the evaluation and the adjudication committee. What then happened, the wrong formula is applied, the issue of the 10T has been changed, and the specification committee that agreed on the steps are not the ones that before the evaluation committee. Already in that process, we've got a mess, but because of that omission. Now, so the evaluation does the evaluation based on, on all the requirements, and then it makes a recommendation. It makes a recommendation to the adjudication committee. The adjudication committee in the supply chain process is the final stage that makes the award, based on what they get from the evaluation. So if the evaluation has done something wrong, it is likely that the adjudication committee will also make the wrong finding, because they are feeding from that committee that is using the wrong material. Now, unless it is picked up at that stage, then the award will be made based on that. So, even as an evaluation, even as adjudication, there is no direct responsibility between the committees and the accounting officer or with the CFO. Because if anything like that were to happen, that would be interference with the process, then fairness is dangerous. The only stage where it now comes out of that procurement process is when the citizen of the bid adjudication says, I am satisfied, based on the adjudication, based on information from the BEC, that is how we can award. Then you put the same stamp of approval. Once the stamp of approval is done, then it comes to the accounting officer, who, let's show you the example of the form that is right. There is an important provision in that document that says that they warrant that the supply chain process is in order that has been followed. That is a formal declaration. It says, any person who's been involved in the process prior to that, you are right, that all processes that were required by law, policy, and regulations have been followed. Because it would be quite untenable to have the accounting officer to redo the process to satisfy herself, obviously, of course, that the process is in order. But because the person that has been trusted, committees, including the management of supply chain, have done that in accordance with the process, then you sign it off. Now, when we come to the stage of execution, when the winning bid could not implement, these other undertakings that were made outside those four processes then arrived. Now, in order not to be confused, we said, let's use this. Let's investigate. That's how the investigation came up. Then in that investigation, the issue of the supply chain manager being in different committees and advising, it has never been an issue. It has never arose. It has never been an agreement. There has never been a misdirection. There has never been suspicion of any wrongdoing in doing that. In fact, the positive of the SFF is that we should rest and be comfortable that we have assigned and deployed the right expertise in those committees to advise that this you can't do, that you can't do. But if you have a bad motive, you get a wrong advice because you've got an apparent motive. And I'm not suggesting that it is, because there is no such finding, as you said. If there was such, then he could have done it. There is a likelihood that he would do that. But none of us would pick that up. Now, what investigation now has the benefit, not only of reading the documents that have been done in the different committees, it goes into audio. They listen to the PC when they deliver the quota. But why are these committee members talking about what happens if they favor the quota? No, the chairperson is sitting there with his hand. Why is she allowing these wrongful discussions to happen to me and her mouth? This is wrong. But it's not the duty of the CFO or the duty of the executive committee to know those details. The only way we would really need that it is because they came out of the investigation, because the investigator has the benefit of listening to that. And that's why, because the volumes of the record, the number of people to be interviewed, the number of documents that have to be investigated, led to the cost that you saw on the screen. Now, is that process better than shared?
I found out now.
Okay.
I think we, yeah.
And in addition to that, I want to go over to page 9, in as far as the different amounts concerned, because that's concerning. If you read page 11, paragraph 9, that talks about the different figures that submitted to the committee. Chapter 6. There's one simple explanation. It is not because the figure we just changed. It is because of a VAT issue. The amount was 88 million initially, and that is the VAT in actual fact, but it was exclusive of VAT. When you include VAT, it changes to 100 million. So then, because of that correction of the VAT inclusion and exclusion, it has to be corrected. But it is a juristic process. It's not a mean change. It has to go through the process so that the bid application can say, we have satisfied ourselves that the bid is 88 million, right? But that should have been included. Now that it's included, it goes to 1 million, then we endorse it, and it goes back to the accounting process.
Thanks,
Judith.
Shall I move on to the next question?
No, no, no.
Oh,
okay. Let's see. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. It's really fine, but I can see why here. In the question, but it does not stop the fact that the ability of the accounting office should be on their toes when the issues are to be worse. At the end of the day, someone must take the blame in the company, and if one thing to support them, it should be the accounting office. Including these people, this chairperson, only of them, in them, there are no minutes on file documenting the deliberations of the bid evaluation committee meeting of the 18th, which was the final evaluation, whatever tender, you know. So those things have been seen in the process before business. So I hear what you're saying, but it does not take you as the executive of the hook, more especially the accounting officer. The question then that you must not answer now is that how many, because the only time that you could see yourself that is a problem is when you could not, on 1st of March, that how many tenders that have been manipulated without you having them, because would you have gone in on the 1st of March? You have never gone to any forensic meaning that it means therefore that number of tenders, it might, that number of tenders have been manipulated under your own nose. Honorable colleagues.
Chairperson, thank you. It's now after table 12, and I've been waiting since 9 o'clock for my questions to be answered. Please can we ask them to give me an answer?
Honorable colleagues, the questions that are answered here are not for one member. And every member, I'm not stopping any member who wants to get more clarity on the questions. So there is nothing anomaly in what is happening, because at the end of the day, you also need to understand what went wrong. You know, so it's not about my questions, it's about all our questions.
Oh,
it's fine. It's unfortunate that you are still coming, but it's for all our questions. No? Mr. Rain, another person.
Okay, thanks. So I think that, as I understand it, the next set of questions, the result of the questions in the three inquiry, which I think we've really been discussing, they were about why identify who's accountable, explain the process, and I think we've gone through all of it, so I've just seen the process. So then the next question was from Honourable Obegram. And the question that you raised was, when we started, we said there were low cost and good, but then 3 million, but I think that Honourable Lee also asked me that question. I tried to articulate it differently when we indicated that the process is that the we were talking about the fact we hadn't paid the unsuccessful bidder any money in relation to that. If that's an order, then the next question was around who are the members of the CC. So the company that bid was Putlocker Investment CC, and there were two members of the CC, only the one of which I can remember right now, which was a gentleman called Arthur Kuku, who then transferred the membership of the company to a Milestone Investment, initially CC, then PTY Limited. He was the sole director of that company. When we've done an offer search in relation to the ownership, that is a whole structure which is owned by an organization called Bahumi Investment Security. And we advise that that is, in terms of Securities Exchange and the Companies Act, you can't get the details of who exactly is the membership in relation to that unless you ask for the securities register. And you have to have good reason to ask for it. And our legal advice is that we don't have good enough reason because the entity that we did business with was an individual entity, even though it's got other ownerships, and that we have enough information in proceeding in relation to that. So that's basically who the ownership was, and I understand it. You remember the other guy? I can't remember, see if I can look up. I think that the important question then was around who did the audit, and the people who did the audit was Integrated Forensic Solutions. It was arose out also of supply chain process that was followed by the CFO, first of all, but in the capacity of CFO, not through the supply chain department, and they were awarded based on the open bid and the process that was required. Then the question that you asked in relation to the cost of the free inquiry, I certainly agree to a certain degree in the context of the CCMA's role in the labour market that kind of costs that were spent there, the challenge in relation to that, but I think it's very important, and I think the questions that we've given today show that there are very senior people in the organisation who are involved, and those would be the people we would usually utilise to conduct disciplinary inquiries and to deal with the process. So it would be very difficult for me to ask the head of legal to conduct a disciplinary inquiry, which is actually personally involved, likewise the CFO and possibly the accounting officer as well. So based on that decision, the decision was that we needed to actually get independent contracting out in relation to that. While that is in relation to legal fees, we actually used the part-time commissioner at the statutory rate to be the chairperson of the inquiry. And we did it in that context. The CCMA tried to deal with the disciplinary process as quickly as possible, but because of the legal challenges and other issues, even though we didn't necessarily think that that was correct, there were delays, and that's because we were entitled to a fair hearing, and we also must abide by those rules. I think the next question is what actually went wrong.
In saying the disciplinary process function as a result of the reasons that you have stated was therefore outsourced, you had to look for other people outside.
No, not always, okay. But we used our lawyers to assist us in part of it, and then in order to get a chairperson, we used a part-time commissioner who would be seen as an independent contractor. So yes, that's an outsource.
That's how many?
Well, the person would have been paid a part-time commission fee for the work that they did. The next question relates specifically to the suspension and how long this individual was on suspension. The suspension and the disciplinary process lasted for 5 months, from August to the end of March when the process was resolved, but the disciplinary inquiry was running all that time. And with nearing finality, as I understand. Okay. Now, we have taken disciplinary processes, as I indicated in my initial presentation, against either calling upon members of the bid adjudication committee, the bid evaluation committee, to answer to me, personally as an accounting officer, why they didn't pick up the issues that are raised, and to give answers in relation to that, in addition to the facilities manager of the CMA at the time, and the secretariat in relation to that process. The head of legal, just for clarity, was not Commissioner Mariani, who was here at the time, and he has subsequently retired, so it was difficult to proceed in that context. And the processes have been followed insofar as either a written representation has been made, inquiries have been held, corrective action has been taken, training. Everybody's been forced to come training at the instance of the accounting officer. Different people have had counselling, written warnings, final written warnings. We have a spreadsheet. We're quite happy to make that available to the committee in relation to that chat. But there are one or two that haven't been finalised. That's why we said they're still in process in relation to this. I think the next question was about have we reviewed the internal controls and the process and the oversight body. I would suggest, and if there's another further question, we've actually dealt with that in quite a lot of detail on how the committees work and the oversight and how we've had to implement and learn from the forensic investigation report. So with the leave of the chairperson, I'll reach the next question. And in the question in relation to the R3 million that COVID has only just begun, the CCMA has also looked and has been reporting 32 Finance Committee, the Audit Committee and Governing Body, the contingent liability that could arise around the process, which is possible damage claim against the CCMA, let alone what we might have against somebody else. And at this point, because we understand that the building was taken into account and bought for a certain amount, we estimate that if we were sued, but it's very unlucky now that the building had been sold, that the building was bought for the cost of R30 million. And that there were R5 million spent as a rounded up number in relation to the costs and the processes of getting the building ready to the extent that it was to take beneficial occupation. So we've disclosed that at this point in time, but it's unlikely, very unlikely at this point that we'll actually have to meet that kind of damages claim. And as has been really pointed out, we could actually claim damage back in relation to the process here. If I can move on to the next question, Honourable America.
Sorry, Madam Commissioner, there was very little said about, they said at one stage, and I said to ask a question about the, there was a cost order at one point to recover those costs, and I said, in fact, are you not pursuing damages? You haven't actually answered it. You've just alluded that someone might pursue damages against you, but why are you not pursuing damages against the individual?
We are evaluating all options in relation to legal proceedings. Bearing in mind that as the situation stands, and I've established the chairperson, that the process is unfolding. So we only established that the building had been sold on, literally in I think that was a confirmation last Monday. So we haven't had an opportunity to reevaluate what our damages claim would be in relation to that process. But we certainly are doing that, and we will be looking at the, if possible, damages. But we would have to then weigh up, and what we do constantly as an organization is, do we want to pursue a damage claim, because then you also have to pay a legal fee and a huge legal cost that go with that. Would you actually succeed in getting all that back from someone who may be a man of soul and not have any assets should we proceed? So those are all the business decisions that the CCMA would have to consider and make recommendations to its board on before any decision is made whether we pursue that process. And we haven't actually got to the full extent of what the options are in relation to that, but we are considering it, and we're meeting with our lawyers constantly, and in fact we're meeting with them in the course of this, we discuss those questions. Sure. The next question was that if we had to restart the bidding process, how long would it take, and what are we going to do about that? Can you help me with that?
Of course, the cost for the fee, actually the fee for the disciplinary proceedings. I'm worried about it, more especially when you are saying that you abuse people who are already inside. You are using from the resource that you have to get up to that amount. But I'm not going to delay the process. Maybe you will talk about it in the process as to what is that you did. That you to pay almost to the right amount. I don't know who's
going to speak this time. I'm going to ask you to explain.
Madam Chair, in my last submission, I said that taking account that the High Court application was looming, and we went to the Labour Court because we were defending an action, and because of the involvement of members of the executive, therefore the function led to an outsourcing of the function of the DC, the systemic process and the labor code process. So what the process entails was a law firm was appointed that not only dealt with the disciplinary, it also dealt with the labor code process, also the current one that's dealing with the high court application. So in all the documents that were involved in the entire tender, which is the biggest other thing that led to the cost arising in that process, the perusal of each and every bundle, which was a bundle of documents that they had to go through, for purposes of ensuring at the time you draft your charge sheet, it reflects all the wrongs that were, not only the matter of the investigation report, which was given by the integrator that they've spoken about earlier. So at the rate that they were charging for all this function and in the DV, for all the days, the preparation, for all the witnesses that had to testify, that's what led to the cost that you're talking about. Because it was not an internal person, it was a law firm that was employed to do not just the disciplinary hearing, but the high court issue as well, inclusive of the labor court work as well, including also the working with this investigator, and as far as all the annexes that were involved in it. So the perusal, the actual appearance, the interviews, and appearance of course was actually what led to the cost in terms of it. In the ordinary course, Madam Chair, on a matter that is not as high profile as this one, we wouldn't do that because we use the internal process, so we don't have those kind of costs that we can. But because of the level of involvement, because we said this is a case that involves 100 million rand, this is the case that could lead to fraud and corruption, this is the case that could lead to the commercial crime unit, the commercial crime that has been committed. Therefore, we have to allocate the resources to that extent, and the person can do it in a fair manner. That's what led to that decision. That's what led to the cost that we have.
Thank you, Chair. The question was that you have to start the process again. How long does it take? And my understanding is it takes 3 years to get a process going. 3 months to get the process and to do a further tender process in relation to the board. Madam Chair. Then the question was on the conduct contingency plan that the CCMA has arriving at November. I certainly agree that we face a huge challenge in relation to finding a home for the office. Our first prize is get a short attention from the existing or old landlord in our Darlington office and then try and follow a supply chain project if we can. The challenge, of course, in the catch-22 we face is that the old award still stands, and until the High Court to set that award aside, we are not able to go out on a tender process because there's an existing tender process that stands. But the sale of the building and then the non-responsiveness of the successful bidder has challenged us because the longer we take to get responses, the longer and the bigger our risk is in relation to getting a new building to move forward. But we are trying to put pressure on everyone in relation to them to try and see if we can get clarity or finality on that in course in the next, hopefully the next month, because that would allow us to go out and attend the project. But there are risks to the organisation which our committee and myself as the account officer are trying to manage moving forward. Following up on that, I think Honourable Otis asked a similar question around who is the FLACO and Malto. I'm trying to answer the details because I know it's the director. The building has been sold to a company called Grand Parade Investments. Who are they? I have no idea. But that's who's been registered owner, and we've got some confirmation via the Nedbank lawyers that that is who bought the building. We have tried to check that through the DEIS office where title deeds are registered. It's not showing at this point that we are, but I think that there's a delay from transfer to implementation. We were advised by Nedbank that they were settled for the money that they were owed. So that immediately implies the damage that the bidder could have had to mitigate that going forward. The next question relates to the supply chain manager and sitting on all the committees, but I think we've dealt with quite a lot of detail already and it's been explained. Again, in our handbook, she is a senior commissioner who is head and responsible for bargaining councils in the CCMA, but she also sat on the bid evaluation committee and chaired the committee for that day of the hearing. Then the next question was,
there's a gentleman there at the back. I'm not sure if he's part of your answer, right, or wants to speak. to know him.
Madam Chair, just with regards to the company called Grand Parade Investments, if I can just offer some information with regards to them. Grand Parade Investments is an investment company, and their main interest is in gaming. You may recall that they partner Sun International in the casino industry as well as other gaming businesses.
The next question was around that, as I interpreted, is it why can we take the committee into our confidence that we have reason to suspect Miyava? Was there something in it for him in the process? I think we've tried to discuss in the process.
That has come from.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
What was the answer?
Okay. I thought that was my question. My apologies. Hold through the question.
The question was, do we have reason to suspect Miyava? Do we think that there was something in it for him, or was it inappropriate? I think the situation is that based on our presentations, we certainly initially maybe thought that there was something untoward. As the situation stands at the present moment, and investigations in this regard will always be ongoing because it's never gone away, is that we don't think that there was anything untoward at this point. But the conduct certainly indicated and implies there could have been, but at this point we're unable to show this. And we're certainly also unable to show, but I think with the follow-up question, is that were other officials involved in relation to the process? At this point in time, we're unable to show that there was anything in relation to that, but that process is also ongoing. Then the next question was in relation to the damages claim, and are we suing for damages? I think I'll have addressed that. And the next question was around also on damages in relation to the fact that Podlako and Milestone were in breach insofar as not giving a seat in my occupation and now in selling the building. We totally agree the sale of the building is just new information, and we're busy getting legal advice around what the process should be and what we should do going forward on that. And I'll have to explain to the committee as soon as I get that advice. I don't want to sit down and say what I'm going to do because I don't know the answer. But that's where we are at this point in time. But there's obviously some uncertainty. But I don't know if the head of legal wants to add that.
Madam Chair, on the question of damages when it comes to the first respondent, the Milestone, in terms of the entire case, we are seeking cost against anyone opposing, and they are opposing us all city costs. Now, we did ask this question, whether at this stage that contractually they are supposed to tell us when they're selling the building, and they did not do that. And our initial discussion with our attorneys on record here was, look, the only technicality that we're facing is that they were needed, our economic issues. But the issue was that there is a pending application to certify the same debt. So would it be coherent to bring in an action of damages when you are seeking to certify the same debt? So that's the discussion that we're having with the Matsumo.
And that was going to deliver?
Yes, yes. There are because in as far as the non-delivery part is concerned, I think we must consider it from the following perspective. That there is likelihood that they may take action at the decision maker as well. But there is that possibility as well, because we don't know what the term of the agreement is between Parade and Milestone. Secondly, is that we could not have had two processes running at the same time, having to certify the award at the same time, the building of breach against the same award. So these are the technical questions that we are deliberating in-house. And that's options that are available to us that we can claim from this. Definitely, because we can't just claim that must claim damages. The question is, we must be able to quantify the damages, because we are the one liable for 100 million rand, it's not the other way around. So if you talk damages, we must quantify the nature of the damages and extent of those damages, whether they are the claim or not, and to what extent. There are those kinds of considerations that are made, but in the process of doing that, we have acknowledged all the things we are doing, And if we find when we make the final decision, whether we are claiming damages or we are not, we will definitely report to this committee. But this is the decision taking, and these are the reasons. But this stage, we, in terms of the prescription act, we cannot also be liable to lose that claim because we don't even know whether we have a claim or not. Specifically on the damages part. So as soon as we know what our claim is, we will act according to that, and also as advised on the television record, what it is actually not. And to the extent that we are wrong, to the extent that there is a damage due to the CCMA, we will act and require and recover this damage.
I may have missed this one. When did Mr. Mayaba leave? Because I'm checking, you are still consulting lawyers on whether to pursue this line of showing people or not. You might pay out some of these employees their pensions until later, and it will be a futile exercise.
What I'm saying, Mr. Mayaba left in March 2015. And if indeed there is a decision and there's an actionable claim by the CCMA, I think it is not necessary for it to be with us or to sue him. I understand as far as the man is concerned. Remember also that if you want to claim against a person's pension, there are limitations in terms of Section 37 of the Pension Fund Act. And also your damage must be limited as far as that legislation is concerned. So those options you consider, but you must have an actionable claim and have it done and order them as a danger. Because the question of defamation, we can't stop him from doing it. And the fact that he's left is not preventing us from acting against him. Even the police can arrest him if there's anything wrong in as far as that is concerned. So I do understand that it is always the best scenario that you act against somebody when they're in your employ or at the time when they leave, because you can bring an application against the Pension Fund Act. In terms of Section 7. But because it's left, that option is out, we will pursue other avenues. But it does have properties, it does things that we can attach eventually if you have to take those actions, if there is an action of the claim. I'm just saying, just to give a comfort, that it's not the fact that all is lost. To the extent that we can act on actionable actions arising from another, that's when we are with a think that we can see the new power.
In terms of my notes, the last question, or maybe second last one, why have we not given the forensic audit report? We're very happy to give it to the chairperson, and if the chairperson wants to give it to the members, there'll be no issue, we will email it to you.
Any other question is on the change of the name. The shareholders are told, who are the shareholders? Were the Sun International and the Game Park?
Sorry, Madam Chair, not Game Park, gaming as in gambling.
Okay.
Gambling, that's right.
Okay, those are shareholders.
No. Grand Parade Investments itself is a listed investment company. They partner with Sun International in other gambling investments. Not necessarily that in their case, in the purchase of this building, that Sun International may have partnered them in this particular transaction, Madam Chair. The reason I'm mentioning them is just to clarify what type of company and their main investments are. Madam Chair, if there's other information with regards to Grand Parade Investments, the questions that you're asking, I can try and answer to them, but that's to the best of my knowledge. They are.
And she just add, and she, it's Black Economic Empowerment Company, the major franchise holder of Burger King in South Africa. Facing Cape Town. Grand Parade Investments.
What I wanted to say is that we have already given an instruction, because we also have a few of interest to know who they are, even as far as the shareholding is concerned, because the number of requirements in terms of our billing process that we have set, in terms of ownership, in terms of the DE, and so there are a number of implications that comes with change, and we have a specific interest. And I'm saying, Chair, when we come back, we hope at the time we come back, as soon as we find who the shareholders are,
and a regular question that we ask, we attempt to provide it to the committee so that we can also put you in the same loop.
Thank you very much, CCMA, for affording us this opportunity to ask questions on this forum report that we have been hearing about. I think the processes that we have gone through in terms of the marking on the forensic report was a good one. However, it does not take the fact that you are not involved in that. Because my worry is what I've raised earlier on, that would you have not been disappointed when the time when the service was supposed to be delivered? Who would have not known? And the question is, how many of those that have gone through without you having not known? How many tenders that have been manipulated? I think we can form an opinion on what you're saying. And then with those few words, You can be it, but I'm making closing remarks. I'm not giving anyone anything. We have all the time to lift up. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the committee for listening to us and engaging and asking questions, because it's always a learning curve for us as a management to hear questions and to see maybe we didn't hear aspects and conflicts in relation to that. Chair, if I may, can I also, we've handed in today also just a biography of all the follow-up issues that were requested from the committee. I think the committee secretary has it just in case that you didn't understand what we said today. More than share this. But thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Anything
else?
I have asked before I come to listen. Before I spoke, I've asked if there are no questions. I did ask them.
No, there are no questions, sir.
Yes.
I said at the beginning that housekeeping matter of the agenda of the program, it doesn't involve this issue.
Yes. Okay, now I hear. Thank you. My apologies. If you can excuse us, let's then pause for 5 minutes and
thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can we get to the problem? Do you want to Zolina to talk to me? To all the other people who are not much for Rachel? What is that?
Chairperson,
yes.
Our program says that we are meeting this week for a briefing by Headlack. And then I get from Zolani to all committee members an email saying that this week their briefing is by the Central Services Committee.
Tomorrow.
So that has been changed without consulting the committee, and I just want to know why it's changed and why we were consulted. That's what I'm trying to find out.
Oh, okay. No, Honorable, only there will be times when the situation does not allow, because this program must be signed, when changed, must be signed off by all House Chair. So if I'm consulted and being told that because the program has changed, your program has changed, at times I will take decisions, but in most cases I do consult you. But this program, when I left Parliament, I remember you are finding sitting outside the chambers, and then he told me how the program has changed. And knowing that all we want all these things, including sitting today, we know some of the members are not there, but it will keep on postponing all these issues and end up not doing the things. So that's the reason why he has to change. I do understand that I will consult, but bear with me when there are. When there is no time and we have to take a decision, at least I will take that decision. Honorable Olive.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thank you for that explanation. So what you're saying, somebody else changed our program? Because you're saying that some committee chair...
No, I'm saying the program of the House. Our program only changed when there's a change in the House. That's the only time. It's not someone else, and I'm saying, for instance, to sit today, we know that we are going to be few, because most members who are members of the committee, they sit on Tuesdays, so that they are here on Wednesdays. But we were going to delay further all this. Remember, we have all these investigations that are coming down, and we want to do this program as soon as possible. So it's not external. It's external only because of the parliamentary program.
Why don't we get it like tomorrow?
No, because we had is still coming. Essential services, I also thought that is something that is very important. CCMA network and essential services, I took it as the most important issue that we need to deal with in the committee. So it's still coming.
Could we
There's a conference in NetLeg that was beyond our own.
So there is a concern currently that is taking place. So then it is because of that reason. Otherwise, they are still on the tape. Honorable Oli.
Thank you. Now I understand what you're saying. Just one last question.
Okay.
What is the news at for Nedbank? Because we haven't got that.
It's here.
No, we don't have that. What you've got.
Okay.
We have nothing from.
It's here.
Thank you. Can you allow me to please just send us an email for that? Because we don't know that.
Okay. Sorry for that. And remember, next week it starts NRA. Let me mention one thing, members. We've been invited by the minister to attend EILO, and we've made application and have made application for all the members. But then the speaker came back with only 3 members. And if it's 3 members, it means we'll have 2 members of the ANC and 1 member of the opposition. And I have consulted with the official opposition, and we have a person by the name of Honorable Ollis. And we've done that. And on our side, we have Honorable Lolio. And Uzulani, as soon as the process is unfolding, is going to be conducting members.
Chairperson, in that regard, Osha, I'll be recording, I've just forgotten your surname, had contacted me about the availability and dates and so on, and it seems that we're going to have to fly on the 30th or something of May. And it's 2 weeks, which means Nedbank will not be able to be on the 3rd of June because yourself and myself and another member will be out of the country.
You see, you are privileged. I don't have that information. I don't even know. I've been waiting as to when we are leaving. Let me get to that and look at it, and then we'll come back to you. Thank you. The meeting is at 10.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.